Globe editor Brian McGorry starts things off on today's BPR. We'll discuss how he decides what stories and polls to run when the clock ticks down to Election Day. And what did you think of Charlie Baker crying at last night's final debate? Then we'll ask you, it ended at Muskie's campaign for the presidency, propelled Hillary Clinton to a victory in New Hampshire. What will last night's emotional moments do, if anything, to Baker's quest to be governor? Then Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us. What's the appropriate sentence for Robel Philippos, and why is security being ramped up at almost 10,000 federal facilities?
Our medical ethicist Art Kaplan on the Ebola quarantines and the ethics of giving out candy to America's fat little trick-or-treaters. Then Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows on young evangelicals telling their elders enough with the gay bashing. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So he joins us every single Wednesday. I was going to say it about this time, but it's always a different time. In any case, he is always the editor of the Boston Globe. Welcome, Brian McGorry. Hi, Brian.
Hello there, Jim Browdy. Hello there, Marjorie Egan. How
good.
Are you?
I'm terrific, Brian McGorry. Good to talk to you, as always. So, you know, we've known you for a while. Jim's known you probably even longer and closer and all that. But we've wondered, when was the last time, Brian McGorry, that you cried?
How about it, Brian? Okay, while you're laughing, I assume everybody knows why Marjorie asked the question. Last night it was asked in the debate of the media consortium, and here is a part of Charlie Baker's answer. Please listen.
And then he said, see those two kids up there? And he pointed to these two boys on the boat, and he said, those are my sons. And he said, they were both spectacular football players at New Bedford High School who were given college scholarships to go play football. And I told them no. I said, you're going to be fishermen.
Wow.
What'd you make of that, Brian?
You know, I don't have my head firmly around what this means, which I assume is the foundation of the question.
It is.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I do know one thing. I wish to the high heavens that I was a columnist again, because
yeah,
you could have a whole lot of fun about a Governor Baker getting together very regularly with the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, for a good cry.
It's true. But, you know, he is a weepy guy. I mean, I've been with him on many occasions. You probably have,
too. What are you talking about? He was in studio a week ago. We asked him about his son who plays football at Union, who won some game for the Union football team.
He
started welling up there.
He was thinking about, I'm sure, the fishermen's sons and his own sons.
I'm sure he was, yeah.
Well, guy, what was the question you asked at our debate last week that
yes,
I thought he was going to tear up?
And we asked
in
him.
Fact, he may have teared up at that.
He
his
did.
His eyes were red-rimmed.
The question was, what's the misconception about you in this campaign, both Coakley and Baker, that drives you most crazy? And his response was something that, you know, all he cares about is numbers and that he doesn't care about people. And he welled up there too. So, you know, the thing is,
By the way, just what I'm thinking about it, Jim, I'm sorry. I didn't know what that text message from you meant this morning, that I should feel free to bring up your performance of last week's debate, but we shouldn't spend any more than 10 minutes on it. Do you want to talk about it or
no?
Not?
I meant that I would leave it to your discretion, and I think so far you're doing quite fine, actually.
Yeah. I'm still very grateful, as I told you, Brian, that I was allowed to ask two or three questions.
Okay, Marjorie, the truth is, Jim is the only human being I have ever met who collapses from exhaustion from running victory laps.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know him well.
By the way, I'm exactly where you are. I'm not sure what the implication. We're going to talk to our listeners about this in a few minutes. You know, Ed Muskie ran for president, crying, allegedly ended his campaign.
Different era.
I know. Hillary Clinton cried in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and most people think that's what propelled her to a victory over Barack Obama in that New Hampshire primary. I don't know what way it's going to cut, but I think what I left last night's debate with, there were five debates, televised debates. Would you not agree that if you stopped 100 people in the street and said, what's the moment or what's the issue or what's the thing from the debate that you most recall? Don't you think that's what people are going to take away from this, that moment?
No, it absolutely is. It was the indelible moment of this campaign. And, I wish I could sit here and tell you this is what it means. This is what the voters are going to this is how the voters are going to react to it. I don't know yet what it means and how it's going to play out.
Well, let's ask a corollary question before we move on. Had Martha Coakley done what Charlie did last night? And she was asked the question. Oh. She talked about being at John Laughlin, who I've known for years, too. John Laughlin, union organizer. He's with the Painters Union. He used to be with the AFL-CIO. His wake, I think, was yesterday. And she talked about that. If she had behaved exactly as Charlie had, what do you think would have happened to Martha Coakley?
It's an excellent question, and I know what you're getting at, and that is that she would not have fared well with that. But that doesn't add up when you look at what the impact of Hillary Clinton crying in New Hampshire was, because that, by every discernible measure, helped Hillary in that campaign.
That's a very good point.
It's an interesting thing because I think you perceived Hillary Clinton and Martha Coakley as two tough women. And Martha Coakley, particularly, we know her well as being a very stoic woman. So it was a perfect question in the sense that Charlie Baker is known to be a weepy guy. I mean, like I said, I've been with him many times. I've talked about his parents or his brother, the gay brother. He starts weeping. And Martha Coakley is known as the opposite. So it got them at both places where in her case, I guess you'd think she's too stoic, and maybe if she had cried, it might have been a Hillary-esque moment. I don't know, but she didn't cry. She was calm and collected about it, and he did what he often does, which is get very, very emotional.
He did.
I will say, I did think that two quick points, if I could. I did think she blew an opportunity there because Charlie Baker was in tears over his encounter with the fisherman. But Martha Coakley could have turned to him and said, Charlie, I wish I had the luxury of tears on this because I don't. As Attorney General, I am the one who sued the federal government to help people, just like the guy that you were crying with. I was in court filing suit against the federal government to make sure that he can earn a living. So I don't have the luxury to sit around and shed tears. I have to take action. And she didn't do that. And that's that was disappointing because I'm sure you remember back in 2013, she did file suit to allow fishermen greater freedom in fishing our waters.
But I'll tell you, that's a great point.
Well, it's also a risky point because I don't remember what she did say last night, but she did cut him off after he went on for quite a while.
Yeah.
And then she did make a comment about the fishermen. But if she chastised him, which is, I guess, what you're...
I'm not talking about chastising, Jim. I'm talking about saying, listen, I wish in government we had time to shed tears. We don't. This is important work we do, and we've got to take action.
Well, you know what? If I were running her campaign, one tact I might consider is that Martha Coakley has dealt with so much tragedy as the Attorney General, murders and child abuse and sitting down with the parents of the dead and the maimed and the raped, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that she has learned to not be cold about it, but this is her daily life, these awful tragedies. And Charlie Baker, you know, is a new man on the block. It's just like in our debate when he talked about taking the ride around with
police,
the cops.
Yeah.
And she said, well, Charlie, I've been taking those rides around for 18 years. You know what I mean?
Point.
Outdo him on the I've sat next to the victims and the survivors kind of thing. But
one more point, and I don't know Charlie Baker well enough to know if he is generally a teary guy, but I will say for both of them that they are at the end of a long grueling process in which I cannot imagine that they are not both emotionally exhausted.
Just
wrung dry of any energy that might be left, and now they're being called upon to be at their very best at what is probably the worst possible time for them. And I think we probably saw a little bit of that, just the emotional toll last night. I will say they gave an excellent answer to the question about what do they miss from their personal lives, having gone through the long campaign. They both made sure at the end of their answer that they talked about the great privilege that it is to run for governor of this state and to be able to go around and have all these conversations with people and to hear what's on people's minds.
You know, speaking of wrung dry, you have to be wrung dry. I mean, Marjorie and I were talking about you yesterday and your job. I assume that every single thing you publish, from a poll last Friday, which showed the most dramatic lead for Charlie Baker, 9 points as a poll out yesterday, saying that he's only up one, to stories that are powerful stories, the whole Greg Sullivan, Sal DeMacy, did she or didn't she say, don't, you know, tread lightly on this, a whole host of issues. How angst-producing is deciding what to go with so close to election day? You're laughing. It must be impossible, right?
Look, we have a lot of we have a lot of excellent editors. We have a crew of some of the absolute best political reporters in America over here for my money. And there are a lot of difficult decisions that are being made over some really extraordinary reporting. And but you know, the reality is this is the exciting stuff. This is why we exist. And I think we're all generally very, very pleased with the way we've covered this campaign. A lot of media outlets in Boston have done extraordinarily terrific work on this campaign, you guys included. And it will be nice to see it come and go after Election Day. But then we're going to have a new governor, and it's going to be great coverage, I hope, by everybody all over again.
So, Brian McCrory, is there a...
How was that?
That was beautiful.
That was good.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful. I'm glad you included us in the group that covered this thing well. Is there... we got to be neutral from here on out, though. Like, the election is on Tuesday, so on Sunday we're neutral, Monday we're neutral. Tuesday morning or neutral? Is it 2 days, 3 days? Is there a cutoff on that?
Yeah. You know, there generally is is something of a cutoff, but I don't have it in my head that it's, you know, the gate closes on Thursday at 4 o'clock.
Yep.
In terms of negative coverage. It's often in your gut, and you also have to realize that, we don't time some of these revelations. We don't control them. So, it's more you do it from your gut on many of these things and what feels right and what seems right. And in the first and foremost obligation that we have is to our readers, that you have is to your listeners. And those are the people you have to keep at the forefront of your head.
As one final extension of the question Marjorie asked, is there going to be a poll in the Capitol section on Friday in the governor's race?
There will be, yes.
There will be. By the way, what did you think of my performance in the debate with GBH and the Globe? I don't know if...
you want to ask him about your column on Sunday?
Okay, fine. It was great. I don't need to hear what he has to say. It was
a pearl of prose.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Brian, on a very serious note, Tom Menino, obviously you know pretty well. We all got some startling news last week. He canceled his book tour, canceled cancer treatment. What's your, it's obviously a very sensitive topic. What were you thinking when you heard that? What are your thoughts in general?
Look, it's very sad. It's extremely sad. And you're right, it is very sensitive. I had the good fortune of getting a phone call from Tom Menino on Thursday, last Thursday.
You did?
I did. He gave me a call in the morning, and I gave him a call back, and we spoke in the early afternoon. And he was very upbeat on the call. He was, it turns philosophical. He was determined. He fully understood the situation that he was in. And we had a good chat for about 10 minutes. And it was great to hear his voice. And what a guy he is. I mean, what an amazing human being he is, and what an incredible run he had as mayor of Boston. So, now it's we're in a sensitive period. We need to be respectful of the mayor and his family, and let them address the medical issues as they will.
How were his spirits in that conversation? I didn't know you'd spoken to him. How were his spirits in that conversation?
His spirits were very good. He was, like I said, he was philosophical. He understood the situation he was in, but he also understands. I don't want to speak for him, but I can speak about him. He understands the amazing life he's led and how blessed he has been, and you know, there's no question in my mind that he was in a very good frame of mind when I did speak to him on Thursday.
That's great.
So, Brian, on a less somber subject, although a serious subject, you guys at the Globe had this piece on these pilot payments that universities and hospitals are making, and the hospitals
or not making,
and the hospitals are doing very well making those payments. Universities not so well, particularly Northeastern, which had paid I think nothing at all, and BU was doing very well. But the bottom line is most of these schools are not paying nearly as much as they're supposed to the city of Boston in lieu of paying property taxes like everybody else does. What's to be done about this? I mean, it's voluntary, but they're not volunteering the way they should be.
It's a really hard one, and let's go back to Tom Menino on this. This is a program that the mayor pushed and has been pushing for several years now. The hospitals, oddly enough, are being very good about
yeah.
it. Very, very good about it. It's the colleges and universities, or a few colleges and universities, that are really falling short of the standard that Tom Menino set. And you point out Northeastern. Northeastern has contributed in other ways. Boston College is another one that has fallen particularly short of the standard that Tom Menino set. BU, as you rightfully say, has been very, very good, very good. But the standard that was the mark that was set for them was not particularly high either. It seems like something that is pretty easily achievable given the public services that they use, given the property that they have, given the privilege of being a nonprofit. But to your question about what you can do, I honestly don't know, because they do get protected status. Is it a public shaming campaign?
Yes.
Is it the mayor constantly bringing this to the attention of the citizens of Boston? I think that's probably the best way to go on something like this.
Yeah, we have Marty Walsh here on Friday. It's one of the things we're talking about. But I had an idea I wanted to run by you. I meant to actually text you this and ask your idea. I read the other day that that the president of Harvard, who one rarely sees, in addition to $1 million salary, makes $300,000 sitting on the board of Staples, which I found to be rather odd. If she contributed that $300,000,
right,
that would reduce dramatically the million or two they're short of their commitment. Is that something you could endorse over there at the Globe, or what?
You're going to get me going on these board seats again.
Boy, would that be a column, or would that be a 300 grand?
I didn't even know that was allowed.
That's what my reaction was.
Stunned. I was stunned. You know, one of Alex Beam, and I love Alex Beam's columns. He's so funny. Always calls Harvard the world's greatest
university.
So I think maybe the world's greatest university should be called on the carpet on this one a little bit more. Maybe Alex can get on top of the job or something. It is just so embarrassing. Are we done with this, though? Because I really want to ask Brian.
Is that really what Staples pays its board members, 300
well,
grand?
The reason it even arose, actually, your paper reported 250,000 last year. And the reason it came up this week is because there's a union that is upset about something with Staples. So it's putting pressure on her, as you know, because she's obviously should be a high profile person, even though she's generally nowhere to be found. And the story mentioned that she is making 300 grand. And my reaction was Marjorie's. I can't believe Harvard lets her do it, nor can I believe, since she makes a million, counting the $130,000 value of her house provided by Harvard, a little over $1 million, that she would even do that. It would seem to me there's enough work to do at Harvard that you shouldn't be spending four or whatever number of days a year being on the board of a private profit-making corporation. I was shocked, actually.
But look at it another way. What is Staples doing paying board members $300,000 a piece? I mean, they're busy shuttering stores and laying people off, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
That's a fine point.
And when you know you go down to Staples now, you see the service. You can see a company that's not at the top of its game. Let's put it that way. Things aren't where they should be. There's not enough stuff. The service is bad. It's kind of sad. But you know what else? Harvard's not in that whole college and university divesting thing, having to do with
climate change.
Exactly, with climate change. Their record on that is not very good. And her quote was sort of unimpressive about that too. She doesn't seem to think that Harvard needs to get on board, as none of the universities have on the climate change front. But anyway,
you know, we should do. I just thought of a solution for you before
what?
We move ahead. Not for you, for him. Why don't you create a phone? What are those things called when authors write under other names? What are those things called?
Oh, pen name.
Why don't you create a pen name, Brian, and start writing columns again for the Boston Globe? Seriously.
Yeah, he's got.
I'm just curious. Jim, when we're on the radio and you refer to me as him, is that me?
That would be you if you're on the line.
Okay, thank you.
How much would you love that, brother? I mean, seriously, think about that for a minute. What do you think? Good. Okay.
I think he's busy.
No,
you know,
how much, Brian? Just answer this question. How much would you like to write that column?
There is a column almost every day. There really is.
Yeah, there is.
Okay, fine.
I used to write one too, and I mean, I'm writing about Catholic things now. You think of these, you could have had a lot of
but
fun.
But you write a Marjorie. You have a terrific column on.
Does she ever?
You have nothing to you have nothing to pine for. You're,
well, no, I do, but it's different. It's different. You're not doing like the sweetheart thing. You know what I mean? I'm now much more.
Yeah, but you're writing about one of the biggest issues in the world at the moment.
I'm much more rarefied now. Let's put it that way. Okay, I'm getting holier every day, Brian. I just want you to know.
But, which we appreciate. We all appreciate that over here.
Yeah, but another thing I wanted to ask you about is the Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, and the prosecution of Robel Filipos. He, of course, is the friend of the alleged marathon bomber. Federal jury convicted him on two counts of lying. You know, the more I read about this case, the more upset I get. He probably is not going to get 16 years. He's going to be sentenced at the end of January in jail. But again, you think, okay, he lied. He lied to the FBI. And we don't know what the FBI asked him about or what these questioning sessions entail because, of course, once again, they don't keep their records. I'm just getting my...
They don't record them. They keep handwritten, allegedly contemporaneous records, but who knows?
Well, who knows?
Exactly.
Have we seen these records? Do we know anything about them? And I'm still reeling from the Whitey Bulger thing with the FBI. It to me, once again, it's like the mighty power of the federal government. It's like Yvonne Abraham talked about in her column, too, the mighty power of the federal government coming down on a kid, and I'm not defending his lying. He shouldn't have lied. But really, do we need to be talking about jail time for this guy?
I mean, I honestly don't have a good answer for that, Marjorie. It's a legitimate question. You raise legitimate issues. You know, the reality is the kid did lie. The kid did lie. And he lied in the middle of a major frantic investigation on an event that has forever changed the city. So he put himself in this situation. But you know, did he deserve a full trial like this? Does he deserve any sort of, you know, substantial jail time? I don't know. I mean, the Globe editorial today pleaded with Judge Woodlock in many ways to make sure we don't send this kid away for any great amount of time. You kind of cringe a little bit when you've watched a whole trial based on this, but I keep getting back to the same point. He did lie. He lied.
You know, by the way, we had Bill Evans in here, the commissioner, yesterday, who I have to say is, I believe, so honest when he's having conversations. And Marjorie or I or one of us asked him about this, and his view was, yes, there have to be consequences. He did lie. But he then went on to the Yvonne Abraham approach, saying, this could be your kid. He said, this could be my kid. He talked about having a kid at a comparable age. And so I guess the hope is that there be some balance in the part of the judge and the prosecution and when it comes to sentencing, which is what Evans was talking about. Yeah,
and that's what Evans is talking about. That's what the Globe editorial sought today. I think that's what that's what clear-minded people are hoping for here. You know, we'll see how it plays out. I will tell you one of the images in this trial that I can't shake is the incredible photograph of Mike Dukakis trudging all alone down that sidewalk, walking into court to be a character witness for Filipos because Dukakis's wife Kitty knows Filipos's mother, who is a worker for a nonprofit doing God's work over there.
We talked about that, and my contention is, knowing Mike Dukakis a little, that even if he were running for president today, he would have testified for that kid, because like or hate his politics, that's the kind of person he is. Hey, before you mentioned endorsements very quickly, I forgot to say something to you before because I didn't read it. You make a point every time we bring up endorsements of the Globe to say you have nothing to do with it. It's a separate department. But tell the truth, how many Baker supporters called to thank you for the editorial you had nothing to do with, and how many Coakley supporters called to damn you? Honestly, I assume plenty, right?
People don't really call anymore. People send email. I did get quite a few about the Charlie Baker endorsement that we had in Monday's paper and Sunday Online. It was, you know, obviously a different kind of turn for the Globe. We hadn't done that since, 1994?
Yeah.
Bill Weld over Mark Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And I thought it was, you know, we have an editorial board. I do not have any say in endorsements. I don't seek any say. I don't have any say. The editor of the paper, you know, for the Globe and virtually every major paper on the country does not have any voice in editorial policy on the editorial page and the op-ed page. But we have a very, very thoughtful editorial board. And I know for a fact that Charlie Baker was not unanimous, but an overwhelming favorite among the many, many board members. I think there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 people who voted, and Charlie Baker did extremely well in that vote.
And by the way, Joanna Weiss, who was one of those people, was on our show on Monday, and she said that while John Henry, the publisher was an owner, was at the meeting, that this was not a dictate from above. Is that your understanding?
It's absolutely my understanding. I'm not even sure he cast a vote. I actually think he might have abstained on the whole thing.
Okay.
Brian McGroy, and we are talking with Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe. We have less than a minute left, but I just didn't want to leave before giving a shout-out to Sarah Schweitzer and this unbelievably fantastic piece of reporting she did on this whale that was basically starved to death, trapped, and endured in terrible torture, being trapped in the ropes of fishermen. It was really tough to read, but it was a really great piece.
I appreciate that, Marjorie. The story chasing Bela about a fascinating Woods Hole biologist who has made it his life's mission to save endangered right whales off the eastern coast from Canada to Florida, and Sarah did amazing work chronicling the plight of right whales who get caught in these fishing lines and buoy lines, and they wrap around their bodies and they prevent them from diving for food, and they literally cause the whales to starve to death, become emaciated and starve. And I hope you noted the particularly strong online, the digital presentation we had for this with the photography and videography that I thought was terrific.
And that's where I read
sound.
It this morning.
Didn't
it
you
is,
have
yeah.
the sound
yes.
of a whale?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sound of what these whales are like when they're out at sea singing, and it was the digital. You know, Sarah Schweitzer is a fantastic reporter. Did a wonderful narrative story, but it was really enhanced by the digital team here at the Globe, who put the amazing package together.
You've never been on a whale watch in your life, correct?
I don't like boats. I, okay. You know, I love the ocean from the vantage of the beach.
I've been on dozens.
Yeah.
Okay, Brian McGroy, I have. It's nothing better than seeing. I'm serious.
Yeah, except when the boat hits the whale.
No, it
then that's
the
not
whale.
So much fun.
Brian,
yeah, it does hit the whale, actually.
Brian, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you actually the day after the election.
That's right.
Good to talk to you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian,
thank
for
you
being
guys.
With us.
Thank
Brian
you.
McGroy is the editor of the Boston Globe, and he joins us every Wednesday. Coming up, the campaign trail of tears. When candidates cry, can it make or break an election? We're going to be joined up next by the man who teared up at last night's gubernatorial debate, Charlie Baker. And then we're going to ask you, is crying a sign of warmth or weakness or neither? Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brodesky. She's Marjorie Egan. Out of all the gubernatorial debates, I think there were five that were televised, that there have been this election season, I am guessing that the one answer that will probably be remembered by virtually everybody was given at last night's debate when both Martha Coakley and Charlie Baker were asked when they last cried. Charlie Baker responded with an anecdote about a fisherman he'd met on the campaign trail.
And then he said, see those two kids up there? And he pointed to these two boys on the boat. And he said, those are my sons. And he said, they were both spectacular football players at New Bedford High School who were given college scholarships to go play football. And I told him no. I said, you're going to be fishermen.
When it comes to crying in politics, I think you could say it goes both ways. You'll remember when Hillary Clinton choked up in 2008 and likely won her the New Hampshire primary. When Ed Muskie teared up, it effectively ended his campaign for the presidency. We want to know at 877-301-8970, how does seeing a candidate cry, as Charlie Baker did last night, affect you as a voter. 877-301-8970. We're going to ask the impossible, by the way, and I know it's impossible. We're hoping that when you give us a buzz, you can shed your partisan hat. I am guessing that if you're a Charlie partisan, you thought it was emotional, honest, and real. And if you're a Martha partisan, you're probably going to say something critical. Try for this 130 minutes, next 25 minutes, to shed that. If you can, I know it's hard, but to shed that. You know, I have no idea. I'm totally where Brian McGorry is. I have absolutely no idea
how this thing is going to play.
Neither you don't
know. All I know is that Charlie Baker is a crier because I have been at lunch with him and you know, known him as a reporter over the years. And he talks about his brother, the gay guy that came out, and he starts crying. He talks about his mother who's been battling, who's been very ill. He starts crying. So he's a crier. And some people are criers and some people are not. Martha Coakley is not a crier. I mean, she's a very stoic kind of person. I mean, Hillary Clinton, I think one of the reasons it was so effective when she cried in New Hampshire before the primary that Barack Obama was supposed to win and did not, mm-hmm. was that it was kind of, you view her as a tough cookie. You don't expect Hillary Clinton to start crying. And when she teared up that day and said she didn't want the country to go backwards or whatever she said, words to that effect, it was breaking the armor, you know, and it was different. You didn't expect that from her. So part of it is, I mean, we see this piece about John Boehner. They call him the weeper of the house. He's crying all the time. He cries over the troops. He cries when they unveil a Ronald Reagan statue. He cried on 60 Minutes. He's crying all the time. So there are some people that weep all the time.
Well, you know, my initial impression this morning, well, I can't, as to quote Brian McGraw, I can't quite put my arms around what the impact of last night will be. My initial impression was if Martha Coakley had done the same thing, it would have destroyed her. However, Brian McGraw interrupted me and said, look what happened to Hillary Clinton, who has, as you said, much of the same stoic image. So we want to know, one, we'd like your reaction to last night. But stepping back, we want to get your reaction to when there are emotional displays from candidates at 877-301-8970. By the way, some Facebook postings, and I'm sure it's pretty clear they're Martha Coakley supporters, say the whole thing is phony. And while I surely do not want to wade into partisan politics, you mentioned Baker with you at lunch. When we asked Charlie a couple of weeks ago about it, nobody was in the studio except us. There was nobody who would see this. When we asked him about his son, number two for Union College, playing football, he welled up a little bit too. I mean, the guy but you may like it, you may not like it. He is an emotional person.
In the debate that we moderated.
That's a very good point, as Brian just said. Yeah,
Brian made that point too, that his eyes were red-rimmed when he was saying that he hates to be mistaken as a guy that cares about nothing but numbers. And when he gave that answer, you could see, I don't doubt for a minute that it's real. I think it's tougher with women crying. You don't know how it's going to play. I mean, sometimes it's viewed as, she's not tough because
women are not tough enough to hold these
positions.
But
on the other hand,
I
don't think
theory?
Anybody would doubt that Martha Coakley, who's been the Middlesex County District Attorney before she was the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and before that was a prosecutor at a time when there were almost no women prosecutors anywhere in the United States, that she's not tough. She's very tough. And so I don't think it would have hurt her necessarily, but it would have hurt her if it's not real.
877-301-8970 is our number. Let's get to the phones. Let's go to Swampscott, where Diane is first. That's right. First on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi there. I love your show.
Well, thank you, Diane. We really appreciate it.
As you know, I live in his hometown.
Mm-hmm. His being Charlie's, for those who don't know Swampscott. Yeah.
It's real. I mean, I don't know the man personally. I know his reputation here. I know that he cares deeply about kids, and this is his thing. He is constantly just always about, I know it sounds so lame, about the children, but he is.
That's a good line, Diane.
I know. I have to say, I was in a room with a bunch of people last night. The debate was on, but no one was really paying attention to it. And when that happened, we all kind of stopped.
Were they all Baker supporters in the room?
No, they weren't all.
And how did supporters. That's perfect. And how did the Coakley people, the Coakley supporters in that room with you, how did they react to Charlie's showing of emotion?
I think it was just a bit of a jaw drop. Nobody really had like a cynical opinion. They just were like they paid attention to the story. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, no one was aware of what the point was at first. I was like, New Bedford fishermen. And then it wasn't until later I understood what the point was. Mm-hmm. That's how kind of real it was. You were kind of listening, but not really listening. And then you saw this guy welled up, and you're like, wow, this must be a really important issue. I do have to say, I think it was real, because when he rolled his eyes and kind of scoffed at that ridiculous question at the end about the costumes for Halloween, it was real. I mean, because did you see him roll his eyes and go, oh, for God's sake, this is... And so I have to say, I think the man is real.
Diana, it was a great call. Thank you. We appreciate it.
I heard he's reduced to tears many times, and Swampscott over the trash pickup issue. That was a burning issue when he was a selectman, and that brought him to tears more than once, Jim.
In the spirit of equal time, by the way, Martha Coakley was asked the exact same question. I think she did answer first. Here is what Martha Coakley had to say.
Oh, boy. Actually, today. Because we were at a memorial service for John Loughlin, who is an organizer for Painters Local 35. I've known him for a long time.
Totally different kind of response, needless to say. 877-301-8970. What was your reaction to last night? And by the way, I really believe, obviously I wouldn't have said it, what I said to Brian, if you stopped 100 people on the street, and it was a subgroup of people who had watched some or all of the five debates, and said, what's the moment that you'll remember most out of this series of debates in 2014? Would you not agree this is the moment, for better or worse, that absolutely everybody's going to remember?
Yeah, it's a big one. I think it's a big one. Also, I thought that they had a answer about the smoking pot thing when Baker's...
when LaToya asked the question?
Yeah, when LaToya Edwards from NCN asked if they ever smoked pot, and Martha said, no, right away, Ms. Law and Order, and he says, yeah.
877.
His parents weren't watching.
301-8970. Let's go to Stephanie. You're in Cranston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Stephanie.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Great.
Good.
So, first, I have a couple points. The first one is, I definitely think there's a double standard there when you're talking about female candidates and male candidates crying. Definitely think, in general, there's a double standard. Second point is, if you're talking about just a downright emotional person, composed to somebody who everybody has their buttons. Everybody has something that you're going to touch upon that will make that person cry, no matter how stoic you are.
I agree.
You have those moments that are definitely real. But there are just some jobs that aren't cut out for people who tend to be emotional people, and that's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's just, for example, definitely as Attorney General, you can't have a crier in that position. It's not conducive. And whether governor is one of those positions or not, that's something that needs to be, I think, looked at by individual voters. But
so you think this will matter to some, whether this will matter to some people come November 4th?
I think this one particular incident, no. I think by now people, the majority of people know what they're going to do on Tuesday.
Got it.
But I think if it's something you see over and over again, definitely. I when you were bringing Hillary Clinton into this and the incident in New Hampshire, the only other time I can really think about her tearing up or losing her composure was when she testified for Benghazi. Like, that's two incidents. Like, the woman's been Secretary of State, First Lady, for how many years has she been in the public eye, and we're talking about two incidents, like, opposed to, I don't know.
We got it.
I would just think that's an important factor for me. I don't want somebody who is going to be making these emotional decisions every day tear up.
Got it.
And
we got it.
Take a box of tissues with them.
Stephanie, thank you for the call. By the way, I want you to hear a brief conversation we had when Marty Walsh was here for his monthly visit right before he went to Ireland. I asked him about how emotional it would be going to his parents' homeland. Here's what Marty Walsh had to say. People I know who have a deep connection to Ireland say this is huge. Having the Irish mayor of Boston coming home is like, what's, are you, well, a crier? I mean, are you?
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
I
it's going to be really emotional, right?
I am a crier.
There it is. He says he is a crier. Perfect timing. Joining us on the line is a guy who was at last night's debate. That would be the very same Charlie Baker. How are you, Charlie?
I'm good. How are you, Jim and Marjorie?
Excellent. Thanks for calling.
We're terrific. We're terrific, Charlie Baker. So I'm wondering, with Charlie, when you got home last night, when the debate was over, you're back in your house. Did you think about how the crying might play in the campaign? Were you worried it might impact it?
No. I mean, the way I think about this stuff, to tell you the truth, is there are dozens, if not hundreds, of probably thousands, actually, if you count all the retail stuff, too, of touch points that take place over the course of a race between the candidates and the voters. And I think most voters, in the end, make their decision based on an accumulated point of view about the candidates, based on everything they see and hear, both directly and from their friends and their family and everybody else over the course of the race. And I think for some people, it may have been a moment, but it's going to be one in combination with all kinds of other moments over the course of the race. And frankly, I think that's kind of as it should be.
Well, you are kind of a weepy guy. I mean that. I mean, well, you are. You're pretty emotional. I think you know. I've seen that with you in studio here. I've seen that in our debate. I've seen that, you know, when I've talked to you off the record.
Well, I'm certainly a passionate guy. There's no question about that. I don't deny that. I mean, and that you know, that, like with most people, your strengths or your weaknesses. I think my passion makes me a better. A better person and a better leader, and it makes it possible for me to get people to follow me on things. I think it's a lot of why I've had success in a bunch of leadership roles. But let's face it, you know, passion is also the type of thing that improperly applied can create other kinds of problems and issues as well. But I think most voters, when they go to the polls on Tuesday, it's going to be a combination of a lot of things that get factored into how they make their decisions. But as I said in the debate with you and Jim last week, it bothered me that all these people are out there saying I was just a numbers guy, because I'm not. I think numbers matter, and I think they're important. But I'm fundamentally about trying to do things to make things better for people, which sometimes means you have to make hard decisions. But it's better to make the hard decisions than ignore them and make the problem worse, which is what happens many times when people choose not to make hard decisions.
Hey, Charlie, just so you know, you're not alone. When our old radio station told us they were flipping to hip-hop, I cried too. So I want you to know. It's not... Hey, Charlie, before you go away.
You guys seem to have landed on your feet, though.
Relatively well. Yeah, relatively. Yeah. Hey, Charlie, but in the moment, because people are always thinking about the inside of politics. When you're asked the question, and I'm going to paraphrase what you said, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this. And you paused for a second. What shoots through your head when you're about to answer the question, or is there no thought? You just reactively answer what's put in front of you. What'd you think?
Well, I actually had the time to think about that because the Attorney General answered that question first. And when the question got asked, when was the last time you cried? I knew immediately what the answer to that was because it happened on Saturday, right? So,
whoops.
I think we lost.
Lose you?
I think we lost him.
It seems we lost the connection. Hey, Charlie, thank you. I hope you're listening on the radio. Thanks for calling in. That was Charlie Baker, who is the Republican candidate for governor. And by the way, in the spirit of fairness, he's calling back. Actually, he's here. He's calling back right now. But I should say, just so people know, that we are operating in our truly fair and balanced way.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry about that.
I knew the AG was answering the question, and I thought to myself, okay, I know when the last time was I cried. It was Saturday, and I know why, because I was trying to tell somebody that story. And so my initial thought was I could try to tell that story again, or I could pick something else. And, you know, and at that moment, I just thought, you know what, that is the answer to the question. At least I'll get that part right. I should just go ahead and answer it. And
And you did.
And I did. But I couldn't get through it because I'm a dad. I have kids. And if I ever thought I did anything that fundamentally ruined their lives, it would just kill me. So that's why that story is so hard for me.
Charlie, how you feeling with 6 days to go?
I feel good. I mean, I wanted to run a certain kind of race. I wanted to talk about the issues that were important to me. I wanted to chase what I called 100% of the votes at the beginning, which meant campaigning in a lot of places that I didn't campaign in 2010. And I feel that we've done that, and I feel really good about the vibe we've got from the voters on the ground, and I think that's been reflected in some of the latest polls. And I'm just going to work like mad between now and Tuesday to do what I can to continue to promote our message and hopefully be successful on Tuesday.
Hey, Charlie, we really appreciate
you
calling in.
For calling in, and we appreciate it. We are talking about crying and the function it serves in politics. Does shedding tears affect how you think of a political candidate? We're going to keep this conversation going up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady, Marjorie. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about crying specifically because if you missed last night's gubernatorial debate, the question will likely make the biggest impression on voters, at least in the debates, was when Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley were asked when they last cried. You just heard Charlie Baker explain last night's moment. We want to know, what was your reaction to that? And what's your reaction in general when candidates tear up? And by the way, before you send email, Martha Coakley will be with us in studio on Friday. We'll get her reaction to that and to the whole campaign. 877-301-8970. Just one last thing we want to play for you, and then we promise we'll run through as many calls as we can. We put together a montage of, I guess, political criers, you'd have to call them. Former Maine Senator Ed Muskie, he was running for president at the time, Speaker of the House John Boehner, who was just being John Boehner, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she was running for president in a primary against Barack Obama.
Attacking my rights, he's proved himself to be a gutless coward. Maybe I said all I should on that point. But it's fortunate for him, he's not on this platform beside me.
Making sure that these kids have a shot at the American dream, like I did, it's important.
You know, I have so many opportunities from this country. I just don't want to see us fall backwards. You know. So,
you know what, Marjorie and I are both saying we don't know what the impact of the Charlie Baker thing last night was. Clearly, if he had snorted like John Boehner,
yeah,
it would have been a campaign killer. And by the way, Muskie was reacting to the fact, I think it was the editorial page, or the owner of the union leader, who's a very conservative character, had made some untoward comments about Muskie's wife.
She was like a lush, she was drinking too much and stuff like that. It was terrible. Barack Obama also cried a few times, too. And you think of him as sort of
stoic,
not a
kind of
crier.
Guy, yeah.
But he cried on the day before the presidential election 2008, talking about his grandmother who just died. And again, 4 years later, on the final day of the campaigning, he got a little weepy again. But not clear what he got weepy about, but he cried from the exact same eye. By the way, Beverly just sent a great email.
What'd she say?
And she was quoting that great book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, talking about, I'll just quote what she quoted from the book, that the first tier says, how nice is to see children running on the grass. The second tier says, how nice to be moved together with all of mankind by children running on the grass. The basic thing, point is that she's all for crying at the moment when you're touched, but crying when you're talking about yourself crying doesn't work. So she's implying that it wasn't, to cry about yourself crying. You get what I'm saying?
I do get what you're saying.
Yeah, it's a great point. That are you crying because you're moved, or are you crying because you're happy that you're moved by the sadness?
Got it. Max, you're in Needham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for your patience. Hi, Max.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I don't buy it.
What do you mean? What part don't you buy?
I I've been going back and forth. Who am I? I'm an independent, so
okay.
I wasn't sure who I was going to vote for.
Yep.
And I really, really feel like I'm getting played. I didn't fall for it. He's getting a lot of press out of it, isn't he?
Yeah, but I think as he acknowledged, and I think Brian McGrory acknowledged, and as did Marjorie and I don't think there's any guarantee that this is a plus for him. I have no idea, nor does it sound like he does, if it's going to hurt his campaign or help his campaign. So,
but it's still free press. I just feel like I was being played, and I didn't like it. It didn't feel genuine to me. It felt forced. I still feel like it was forced.
Well, I got it. So does that, you're suggesting that's what made your decision? Is that what pushed you over the edge, or you're not pushed quite yet?
I was looking for something, hoping for one of the two candidates to give me something. And I still haven't gotten it from Coakley. I'm still not eager to put the check mark, in front of her name. But I'm not going to do Baker. If it's not Coakley, it'll be Falchuk.
Great. One of the independents. Max, thanks for your
Thank
call.
Thank you for the call. Mary Beth just said, just emailed and said there was a big-time double standard. If Martha cried, she would be weak. Also, Scott Brown was able to pose nude. What if a woman hadn't posed nude? And she, of course, is referring to the famous Scott Brown centerfold in Cosmopolitan magazine when he was a young and struggling, whatever he was at the time.
Lost
what was he at the time? A law student at the time. That's
hey,
right.
Sheila,
women could not post nude. Where I think we're clear on that.
We agree on that. Sheila, well, they could, but they probably wouldn't be elected to the U.S. Senate. Sheila, you're in Norton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Sheila?
Well, I like the last caller. Initially, I had I started to cringe, I will say. So just objectively, I thought, uh-oh, is this going to be something? Because I didn't know if he was going to say the fisherman was just upset because he didn't, you know, quite catch enough stripers or something. And if that had been the case, I would have thought, where is this coming from? This seems phony. But as he progressed and spoke about the issue with the fisherman and that the fisherman felt he ruined the lives of his sons, I felt it was very real. I think he, you know, probably didn't want to get into the story because of that. But I thought I don't think there seems to be a question of theory, real emotion. And I think even hearing him today, just before I'm calling, I thought he seems very honest. So that's a positive. I would say that with the story, the only thing that probably would have an impact on the race is if we found that there was no fisherman, you know? That would be
a
the
phony
only
fisherman.
Might...
Now, if you don't think the yeah. Globe is on the case, Sheila, we should have asked Brian McGrory that. But that would probably be a...
That might not be good.
That might not be good. That's a good way to put that. Sheila, thank you very much for your call. Let's squeeze in one really quick one. Eric, you're in Stoughton. We don't have much time. Hi, Eric.
How are you doing?
Great.
Good. I will say... First of all, I've only lived in Massachusetts a couple months, and one of the things I've loved is y'all's program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's really a privilege to actually be able to talk to you both.
Thank you.
I will say, in terms of the whole issue, and this is ironic because I work in theater, the theater aspect of politics is what I hate the most.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the whole process of, like, trying to analyze whether or not crying is going to help or hinder a candidate, to me, is just part of the theater. And what I care most about is if... Well, if I'm understanding correctly, Charlie Baker opposes the paid work leave.
Unless the workplace
really
has more than 50 people,
yeah.
10 seconds, Eric.
And that's like a kind of a big deal for me, far more than whether he was touched by the fisherman story.
Eric, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time.
A
great perspective, because those issues are the things that really should matter most. Anyway,
we should say we're going to return to this topic at about 1:30,
yes.
So stick around.
And I also want to say, while we're talking about candidates, next Tuesday is our Cinema Classic Challenge. We're going to ask you if the 1972 film, The Candidate, still holds up. To learn more about this, go to WGBHnews.org. Coming up, we're going to talk with our Homeland Security expert, Juliette Kayyem. That's next on 89.7.
Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem kicks off hour two of today's Boston Public Radio. What's the appropriate sentence for Robel Filippo's friend of Jahar Tsarnaev? And why is security being ramped up at almost 10,000 federal facilities? Then historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us in Studio 3 to discuss three of her favorite things, the Roosevelts, the Red Sox, and teams of rivals.
Our medical ethicist Art Kaplan on Ebola quarantines and the ethics of giving out candy to America's fat little trick-or-treaters. Then Sue O'Connor from Bay Windows and the Michael Sam update saga, and on young evangelicals telling their elders enough with the gay bashing. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. You're listening to Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on 89.7 WGBH. Hi, Jim.
You never quite say it that way. It's, I don't know what
well,
it is.
Well, it's a little, I was diverted
you
momentarily.
Were?
Yes, I
well,
was.
Well, hello to you, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
Joining us, as she does every Wednesday for Open Mic, is Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem. She worked in both Governor Patrick and President Obama's administration. Juliette, good to see you.
Thanks for having me again.
Pleasure.
Thank you for being here. So, Juliette, you are, as we know, a Homeland Security expert, and you're kind enough to come in and talk to us every week. Robel Philippos, who was, of course, a friend of the alleged Marathon bomber, was convicted on two counts of lying to federal authorities in the course of the investigation. He had nothing to do with the attack itself, and he didn't hide any backpacks, but he was found guilty of lying. Faces 16 years in prison. What should happen to this kid? Young man, I should say. He's not a kid.
Well, he's clearly guilty of lying to federal officials, of which, you know, so there's no question in that regard. But I don't know what's served by a long-term sentence in this case. I mean, he didn't plan the attack. He didn't impede the attack. He did something really stupid. Stupid. And anyone with kids has had that conversation about don't be stupid, and yet they're still stupid. And I just, you know, I hope that the judge uses his prerogative, his leniency to say nothing is served by such a long-term sentence.
Well, I think
lesson is learned.
But I think most of us agree 16 years is too much.
Yeah.
Should he go to jail at all?
You know, I didn't follow it close enough, but my gut tells me probably not. I mean, he can serve, service, detention, whatever else. But these are my own personal opinions and my capacity as a Homeland Security person. Look, you want to use the criminal justice system.
You mean your own personal as opposed to what? Your block in Cambridge?
I mean, I say, you know, these cases, this is the first time this has ever happened. My husband is a judge on the same circuit. My opinion
Correct.
Is my
Appellate
opinion.
Court
his
judge,
opinion
yeah.
is his opinion.
Understood.
Or the court's opinion.
We got
so,
that. Sure.
And I should probably make that clear from the outset because we'll be talking about this case a lot. So, you know, I just don't know what's served by a criminal sentence because there's a lot of things that he can do and a lot of things the government can still do to him absent putting him behind bars. But this is a hard issue, I'm very confident that he got the guilty verdict. It will be about him and by him for a long period of time, but nothing is served by a prison sentence.
We asked the exact same question yesterday of Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. He was in the studio, and here's what he said.
I think, honestly, there needs to be some punishment. That being said, I have kids that age, and they make stupid decisions and maybe not realize how big a role they might have played in this whole investigation. So I sort of, as a father, I feel a little bit for him.
I think it was pretty courageous for a police
it
commissioner
is,
to say
absolutely.
This guy. And by the way, he went on to say, we didn't have time to play the whole clip. He thought he should do some jail time, unlike you. But, you know, I agree with much of what you said, Juliette Kayyem, but I want to amend one thing. You said, I hope the judge so-and-so. The people who speak for the United States of America are the prosecutors, Carmen Ortiz's office. I don't want to see her going in there asking for 16 years, the defense attorney's asking for home confinement, and the judge say, well, I'll give him two. I want in my name for some, yes, he committed a crime, yes, he was convicted. I want to see some sense of balance on the part of the U.S. attorney's office, not just the judge at the end of this thing. And this U.S. attorney, obviously we know most importantly in the case of Aaron Swartz, who ultimately took his own life, and some people think it's because he faced this colossal jail term as a result of charges filed by this office. I want to see them exhibit moderation, not just the judge.
Yeah, I think I think that's apples and oranges comparing the two cases. From their perspective, because I have been at the Department of Justice, the entire judicial system, the entire justice system does collapse if we're not hard-ass, so to speak, against liars, right? Because the idea is you take an oath, you testify, you don't lie to FBI agents. So I understand about that sort of psychology within a lot of criminal prosecutors.
By the way, I didn't
offices.
Work in the federal government. I understand it, too. I do understand.
But the reason why we have judges with discretion is they're going to take one side and the other side and then ultimately make a judgment call. And we've seen this before. I mean, let's just keep our eyes on the prize. The eyes on the prize is the brothers. That's our eyes.
But excuse me, the problem is, as we just saw in the Whitey Bulger case, that the government and the FBI has been lying to beat the band about any number of things. I mean, I've interviewed people who went to jail, one guy, Joe Salvati, for 30 years because the government lied and set him up to take the fall. So it does drive me a little bit nuts that a 21-year-old lies, he may face jail time, and the government just lies willy-nilly and gets away with it. And the imbalance of justice. Okay, the federal government comes after you. Katie, bar the door. You are in big trouble. But you can beat up your girlfriend or assault people or rob people with knives. You're not going to jail.
Yeah.
So the whole system is, to me, completely out of whack.
Are you trying to convince me that the criminal justice system needs to be reformed? Well, I did try to run for governor on this issue.
Oh, that was you. I remember.
Yeah,
I knew
that was
I knew
me.
You from
remember?
Somewhere.
Too many people in jail. We have an entire system that applauds itself by the number of people they put in jail for reasons that are human or just stupid mistakes. We are spending more money on putting people behind bars than we are on higher education for our young people. We are putting blacks and Hispanics and generations of essentially boys away. I am with you. The entire system needs to be reformed, and it begins. And we need to change the way we think about success vis-a-vis criminal justice. And right now, success is how many
people. Page.
Yeah. No. I mean, look. I mean, look how good it did me. No, I'm joking.
This is a great bipartisan issue. No, let's not stay
so
on this because Marjorie has worked into a frenzy. Let's talk about another issue that's in your bailiwick. Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, was speaking about these lone wolf attacks. And what happened, everybody spent a decent amount of time watching television, finding out about this horror show in Canada. There was almost no attention to this hatchet attack on police officers in New York City because of the Ebola obsession and because of what happened in Canada. Her quote is in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. She chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee. One of the problems is that the internet, as well as certain specific Muslim extremists, are really firing up this lone wolf phenomenon. These attacks and the multiplicity of attacks in 2014 show that the propaganda is having some effect. A lot of people have been saying this is the threat. These people who operate on their own are inspired by the sickness of more organized individuals. There's no way to really stop these.
There's no way.
Is there?
There's a very little way. Let me just do the good news side of this, which is these lone wolf guys are also the impact of their crimes or their violence is obviously much less than what we saw on 9/11. So the good news is that the lone wolf, not highly trained, not necessarily sophisticated in their attacks, some of them suicide missions, as I believe Canada clearly was, but it's going to be like whack-a-mole. And those of us who have been in counterterrorism have known this for the last 5 or 6 years, is that the successes of disbanding the more hardcore groups that are focused on the U.S., was that you were just going to see men, mostly men, sort of radicalized through various means who are finding meaning in believing that they're part of something bigger. And the best defense against it isn't closing websites or it is integrating, as we have, new communities, religiously diverse communities, into the American fabric. For all the concerns about lone wolf, we have a remarkable storyline to tell about America, which is we essentially don't have radicalized populations. Muslim communities, Arab communities, Hispanic communities believe, and the literature is just clear on this, believe in the American dream because America has embraced them. And the worst thing we can do is begin to isolate these communities. We work with them as law enforcement, as individuals. We ask them to help us if they see radicalization in their midst. It's the only way.
Yeah, we spoke about Evans a minute ago. Commissioner Evans was here yesterday talking about the Philippos verdict and the ultimate sentencing. We also talked to him about the fact that he has elevated the first Muslim to captaincy. Yeah. Does that matter? I mean, he does. Does that make a statement that actually matters to some people?
Yeah. It absolutely does. I mean, look, I mean, you know, as an Arab American in national security, the number of, in particular, young women who came up to me and said, I never thought that I would, you know, want to work at the CIA or that I would work at the Department of Justice. This you know, this idea that America's security efforts could also be, you know, I don't know, reflected by the diversity of America is absolutely where we need to go. And it's exciting. It's going to take a long time for these institutions to change. They're going to have to change how they recruit. We talked about earlier another segment about security clearances, but it is exciting. And then if you have a national security apparatus that looks like the world and acts like the world and thinks like the world, I honestly believe there will be fewer mistakes because the world will seem different. It won't be a bunch of guys sitting around thinking, we think that this will happen if we go into Iraq or something like that.
We're talking to Juliette Kyem, who apparently ran for governor.
I was reciting her platform there a couple of minutes ago, forgetting.
And then she won.
But I heard it before. Okay. So the department.
What's worse, running for governor and not winning, or having Marjorie forget that you ran for governor?
Oh, I knew you ran. I thought it was my own
and then
brilliant
appropriating
idea.
Appropriating your platform,
and I stole
even
it
better
from you. Anyway, do we mention this bulking up thing in the federal buildings?
Yeah, that's all as a result of this lone wolf thing, right?
I mean,
okay, fine.
But we don't know what this means. I didn't realize that we have the Department of Homeland Security is guarding more than 9,500 federal facilities. Wow, that's
Federal Protective Services.
Yeah,
it's a new agency.
A lot of places. But we don't know what this is going to mean. But I assume this is just looking
the
through
obvious.
Your bags more closely, going through metal detectors.
Right. And it's just think of all the facilities. So you're thinking of the Pentagon. If you've ever been in the Pentagon, it's impossible to get into the Pentagon, and that's good. But, I mean, these facilities include the National Guard Armory down the street in Cambridge. I mean, there's just so many different facilities. And essentially, a lot of them are soft targets. So what Jay Johnson, the new secretary of, not so new anymore, Secretary of Homeland Security, simply said, look, let's just ratchet up a little bit. It's a smart response to this just drumbeat of that's what's going on. I just, you know, it's a, I'm sympathetic to people be a little bit on edge right now. There's just like, it's, you know, we never run out of things to say in this segment. It's just been the steady drumbeat for the last 6 or 8 months. And you worry a little bit. So it just makes sense, makes people feel more confident.
In a couple of minutes, we're going to have Art Kaplan, who is, as Marjorie calls him, our medical ethicist. He's actually NYU's medical ethicist,
well,
but he joins us weekly. We're going to ask him. He has very strong feelings that this quarantining thing just a totally ill-informed, if not uninformed. However, in the military, quarantining is becoming the rule for the – well, tell us what's going on and what you think about it.
So I am so surprised by how bad different pieces of the government response have been, because they've all been sort of inconsistent. And how could we not have thought this through? This has been my point with the White House. How could you not have thought that governors might go off on their own 2 weeks before a midterm election? Like, it's not like I have to tell you
Democrats
that, right?
And Republicans.
Democrats and Republicans, that this would become a political issue. That and so now the decision is, and not surprising, is we have about 4,000 ground troops there or going to be there that are going to actually be working on ground.
In West Africa.
West Africa to build hospitals, to create surge capacity, medical facilities, and that they will be quarantined for – this is my understanding. It was just announced 21 days after their arrival here. Now, the military is very different as a legal matter as compared to, say, a nurse who was working for an agency. We own them when they're we being the government, the general, the chain of command owns them and can decide whatever they want to do for those 21 days. But it doesn't make the science any better just because you can do it without all the legal consequences that the nurse in New Jersey posed or for the governor there doesn't mean that it makes any more or less sense. It's clearly a precautionary issue, over precautionary, because if you if one guy comes back with Ebola, you know, you've got a million troops that you're going to start to be worried about. So it's understandable. But this is where I don't get, 6 months ago, we knew this was a crisis. What was going to be the, why do we seem flat-footed or responsive to what clearly could have been anticipated, something like Governor Chris Christie or Rick Perry or the Andrew Cuomo or the Republican House members calling for the closing of the airports. It's just, it was all predictable, and yet we still seem to be catching up.
Well,
so
you know,
why do you think? I mean, you've been there. You have some insights.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've said this in a couple of disasters. It's just this incapacity to sort of think past the tyranny of the inbox. So it's just, I'm sure that there's just so many things going on. It's like, okay, what is going to be our Ebola strategy in May, knowing that there will be someone who gets into the U.S. in September?
So if we had a Surgeon General, which we don't, would it make any difference?
Yeah, I think for having a
clear strategy,
but also just having another voice, a medical voice, is always helpful.
Well, we had talked to John King yesterday from CNN, your former colleague over there, about the disappearing Ron Klain, who has not shown his face. And he defended it, basically saying he wasn't hired to be the face of this thing. Then who is the face of this thing? Is it Barack Obama talking about hugging Nina Pham, which, by the way, I thought was actually a great and generous moment. And I think a lot of people were taken aback, but he made a point in a very graphic way that I think, that I hope had some impact. It is amazing to me, furthering what you say, that there is not a face of this, Frieden, the guy who runs the CDC, maybe a very competent doctor. He is a stuttering defender of the, I mean, it just is. He's just not very good. It is amazing to me that no one other than the president is deputized. Maybe it should be Joe Biden to essentially be the face and voice of the coordination effort on this whole Ebola thing. It's just ridiculous to me.
Yeah, so that's like, I mean, you saw Lisa Monaco, his very able Homeland Security advisor, incredible woman. She had a few press conferences, and then someone else had a few press conferences. What I have always learned is in these situations, and I don't actually know what's going on, you know, behind the closed doors, but they should be having a press conference every single day with whoever this head spokesperson is. If it is the head of the CDC, make it clear it's the head of the CDC. It sounds like it should be Ron Klain. You have a press conference every day. You tell people what you know, what you don't know, and what you anticipated. It is crisis communication 101. Here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. Here's what we anticipate. Every single day.
Can I say one more thing about this? Someone brought to our attention today, because the president has taken a lot of heat, I don't quite get why, on this Nina Pham hug thing. And the person who was in touch with us, he is. A lot of people say it's sending the wrong message. I don't buy that. But I mean, who knows if it's an anti-Obama thing or whatever it is. But you juxtapose that and just go back in history, maybe 30 years. Okay. They sent us the transcript of a press conference done by Larry Speaks, who was Reagan's press secretary at the time. Listen to this. This is right after AIDS begins to be in the public consciousness. Let me read a questioner from a reporter. I don't know who it was. White House press briefing. Larry, meaning Speaks, does the president have any reaction to the announcement, the CDC in Atlanta, that AIDS is now an epidemic and has over 600 cases? Speaks says, "What's AIDS?" The questioner says, "Over a third of them have died. It's known as a gay plague," to which people in the room laugh.
Oh my God.
No, it is. I mean, this is a questioner. It's a pretty serious thing that one in every three people get this have died, and I wonder if the president is aware of it. And the president's spokesperson says, "I don't have it. Do you?" And that is the response of the voice of the president of the United States.
But you know what? You know what? As awful as that is, that was 1982. I mean, when we think that we haven't made progress on certain fronts, it just shows how dramatically the world has changed in our lifetimes. You know?
No, and I mean, that is good news. It also has something to do with the communication. I mean, you know, we've known about Ebola, just the way that information is shared and distributed and people know about Ebola. I want to make clear to everyone, because I'm, you know, we've been on this and someone sent this to me. More men have been married to Kim Kardashian than have gotten Ebola in the United States. So putting in perspective, but one of the reasons why we're struggling with putting in perspective, yes, it's CNN, it's all of us talking about it, but part of it is this, you know, what do we know? What do we don't know? What don't we know? And what can we anticipate? And it's this sense of flat-footedness that I think we have to get ahead of. you know, that Chris Christie and Andrew Cuomo would have felt confident. That's the most amazing thing, to go out a day after they had this wonderful press conference about the guy in New York and create their own standard, even though they can. How is that all a surprise to us, right? I mean, well, if we've been out there every day saying, you know, states can do this, they can't do this, blah, blah, blah.
But I think it gets back to what I was talking about at the beginning with this prosecution of this young man who lied in the marathon bombing. I think lots of people and do not have a lot of trust in the federal government. They don't have a lot of trust that the federal government is not going to come after them. It was some overblown thing. They don't have any trust that the federal government knows what it's doing. They don't have any federal trust in the federal government being able to manage situations. I mean, you're laughing over
I'm
there.
I'm laughing because let me tell, I know Marjorie fairly well. This woman is going to be barricading herself in her apartment
really?
By weeks
after?
End. I mean, do you know, the? By the way, I agree with you about the overreaching of the federal government, but the paranoia, it's growing in you. Do you know that?
Well, I'm not really paranoid.
Is.
I am not paranoid.
I think it's just my segment.
It's not paranoia.
I think it's just
truth.
My segment.
I do understand why people do get paranoid. Please read about, as I said this a million times, the IRS going after these little mom and pop grocers.
No, I'm totally with you. And the fact that the FBI does not record interviews
paranoid.
Is just
abhorrent
in 2014.
Well, the fact is somebody just emailed that we should stop prosecuting young men for lying until we shouldn't prosecute them for lying until we prosecute the government for lying first. So,
well, what did what's the name of the son with the high voice? One of the sons of one of the people killed by Bulger. What's his name? Is it McDonough? What's the name of the guy who does so much speaking on the steps of the Moakley Courthouse?
Steve Davis.
No, I don't mean Steve. No, the guy with the high voice, whatever it is. He said, I think to your colleague, Peter Galzinis, said, how do you feel about this? And I'm paraphrasing. His response was, I don't feel that good at all, because half the people who should have been sitting in the defendant's chairs were not sitting there.
Donahue.
He meant the FBI. You know, we have to change gears before we let you go here.
But I do fear that my presence here sort of raises this level
in Marjorie.
So
no, she's
like
pretty good on her own.
Are you now?
I think I am not happy with the prosecution
of all these
coming out of.
Oh,
she
asked me not to say this. Can I tell you something? She bought 40 cans of Spam yesterday.
I did.
Draw your own.
I'm building a bunker. No, I'm only kidding. But I do understand how people that are a little bit not all there to begin with get to this paranoid state because you see this ineptitude on so many different fronts. But let's move to a happier subject.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's not so happy.
It's gotta be quickly, though.
Well, we talked to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist, about the Halloween is coming up this Friday. And, you know, we are a fat little nation and the little kids are getting fatter and fatter and fatter. And there's this movement afoot not to give candy to trick-or-treaters because we're going to make them fatter.
How many kids do you have again?
I have three.
And what are you doing about that? I don't mean about having three kids, but about Marjorie's thing.
Twix and Bit of Honeys and Butterfingers.
Good for you. I
get it, but I don't like. First of all, these are people who are not talking about obesity 364 days of the other days of the year. Kids should have candy on Halloween. I feel like I'm weird for saying that, but like I don't quite get this momentum otherwise. I mean, that, you know, like in moderation, or what we do is they have these bags and then we let them eat as much as they want the first night, the second night, and then we take the bag away, and then every night for about 10 nights we hide a piece, and then they do hide and seek.
A little
and then
later.
They find
when
it.
Are we talking to Art Kaplan about this?
We're talking about 30 minutes.
Oh, about 30 minutes. Okay. And the last thing is we have a new feature.
I know.
Yeah, now tell us about this.
What is this called? Tomorrow's Headlines or something?
I think we should. You know, I feel like we're always like, oh, God, this bad thing is happening, this bad thing is happening. I think we should talk about bad things that are going to happen in the future.
Oh, that'd be
might
really
just,
good.
Don't you think that that will make us all feel better?
So you're going to tell us what the next big story is going to be.
I think that we, I think, so we're going to try to do this and see how it works. Cuba.
What part of Cuba?
Well, 25,000 Cubans have gotten onto rafts to come here because the economy is not picking up. None of the reforms are happening. After the midterms, we're going to all be focusing on the presidential election and the Hispanic vote. I think Cuba is sort of ripe for not only a potential mass migration because of all the changes going on, but hopefully for reform on our end. So I would anticipate very soon we're going to start hearing about Cuba a lot more because no one is paying attention to this. Cubans are coming in numbers that are equivalent to the 1980s. And that is because we have a stupid law, and I apologize to all my Cuban friends, that says if you get a foot on U.S. soil and you're from Cuba, it's called the wet foot, dry foot rule, you get essentially a free ride, citizenship. As compared to Honduras or Guatemala or any other country that is bad, it's a legacy of the Cold War because we don't like Castro. Like, we need to get over ourselves. We need to change the way we do immigration, comprehensive immigration reform, treat all nations equally. But we're like a magnet, and they need a place to go. So this is going to be a big issue.
Fair enough. We will write it down, and we will remind
you
of it. Juliette Kayyem, it's great to see you. Okay.
Great to see you guys. See you
Juliette
next Wednesday.
Kayyem, thank you, too. Have a happy Halloween, you and those three children.
I know.
Juliette Kayyem joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. She is a Homeland Security expert who worked for both Governor Deval Patrick and President Barack Obama. Up next, she has channeled President Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, and she's alleged to have had an affair with Anchorman and Anchorman 2's Ron Burgundy. That's right. The great historian and writer Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us. Stick around for that conversation. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brodesch. She is Marjorie Egan. Today at our morning meeting, no one believed me when I told them that for today's show, we'd booked Abraham Lincoln, all the Roosevelts, Teddy, FDR, and Eleanor, plus the entire Boston Red Sox team. So here in Studio 3 to prove me right is historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Doris Kearns Goodwin, the woman who I think we all would agree embodies all of those American greats and more. Doris's latest book is The Bully Pulpit. We talked about it a few months ago. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. She also has a huge presence in Ken Burns' brilliant latest PBS documentary, The Roosevelts. Doris, it's great to see you.
I'm glad to be back with you guys, too.
Well, Jim just mentioned, Doris, how you were a huge presence in this documentary in which he managed to pull this off. But you have a familiarity, having written so much about Teddy Roosevelt, so much about Franklin Roosevelt. How did he manage to do this? You did it in words, but he did it in this documentary in incredibly powerful ways.
I mean, the great thing that Ken Burns does is to tell stories. So he understood that he's going to be covering 100 years of history, but he tells it through Teddy, through Eleanor, and through Franklin, their intimate relationships, and then the public story and how he figures out how to structure it. Okay, here I'm going to break off with Eleanor at this point and tell something about World War I. I mean, it was seamless. That's storytelling. That's what I care about in writing, and it's what he does in the film so brilliantly.
Did you learn anything that you didn't know before? I would say, as I'm watching you on the screen, I'm asking myself what I'm about to ask you. I did ask you, did you learn anything you didn't know?
Well, you know, when I wrote the book on Franklin and Eleanor, I didn't know as much about Margaret Sukley because her diary came out later. So I think her insights into FDR and her whole relationship with him came after the book. You know, once I finish the book, I don't learn anymore. So I didn't read all that stuff, but now I saw it on the film.
You know, one of the things that struck me, I have to say, and I've read a lot about the Roosevelts and are huge admirers, mostly through your work. But when you see the visuals, what's the name of that place that Franklin bought and then converted to a health facility?
In Warm Springs.
Oh, my God. In Warm Springs.
Warm Springs.
When there were interviews with average people who would talk about their interactions with the president of the United States and leader of the free world, talking, not the, you know, the perfunctory, how are you, moving by, but showing sincere and deep interest in their life, it was so powerful. It was unbelievable.
And I think the reason it was so powerful was not only for these people, but for FDR as well. Those relationships he had when he went to Warm Springs after his polio were the most relaxed, regular relationships that he probably had. And I think it made him a person who was more empathetic toward ordinary people, so that when he becomes president and he's got a depression and there's all these people who are suffering, he knew how to talk to them in a conversational way, which his aristocratic background might not have allowed him to do. That's why the polio was so central.
And you mean, and the reason he could be himself, the reason he was so comfortable there is because he could be himself. He was with people other than power who were like him, who had experienced much of what he had. Is that what you mean?
And they could share that adversity that they'd been through. And then suddenly, I think he projected when he he saw other people who were suffering from the Depression, or poor people or minorities, they were people for whom fate had also dealt an unkind hand, as it had to him, to give him polio and make him a paralytic in his 30s. It changed him, I have no doubt about it, both the polio and the Warm Springs experience.
Yeah, well, from Ellen's perspective, I guess it made him more empathetic, too, and less arrogant than he had been beforehand. But I want to, this may be, I may be giving you an unfair compliment, but I remember years ago when I read,
because
you may not have been the first. I'm not an historian and you are, so you would know better than I do. But when I read the first thing, not the first thing, but when the first thing I read by you was about the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, and then later Eleanor and Franklin. And I was fascinated, and I said, well, this is because she's a woman, that's why she did this, that you wrote so much about their domestic lives, which I thought had not been done that much by a lot of male historians. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, it's really true. I mean, if you look at male historians writing about presidents in the 19th century, they probably call the president's wife Mrs. X. And there's probably nothing about him, as if these people are just presidents on the stage. We know from our own lives, our family lives, our personal lives, our friendships, our colleagues are part of who we are and part of our work experience. And so now it's much more common, and certainly that was the story of Ken Bird's film, to make these intimate relationships connected to their public responsibilities.
Okay, so good. I'm glad I was right about that. So let me ask you this. Then in this show and in your writing, you talked about some of the terrible tragedies that Teddy Roosevelt and later Franklin too, but Teddy Roosevelt went through in his life. Tell people about those.
Well, I really think that adversity shapes so many of the presidents that I've studied about. I mean, Ernest Hemingway once said, everyone is broken by life, but afterwards some are stronger in the broken places. And that's true of Teddy and Franklin. I mean, Teddy had life-threatening asthma as a child, and it meant that he couldn't be physically active. So that developed his reading and his bird skills and all sorts of things. But at a certain point, his father said to him, Teddy, you have the mind but not the body. And without the body, you're not going to go as far as you should. You must make your body. So the kid goes into this incredible, you know, regime of up and down on the bars and horizontally, and he becomes the strenuous man. And then again, he suffers death as a young man. His beloved father dies when he's in college. His first wife, Alice, dies after childbirth. And he goes off to the Badlands in a huge depression. But suddenly he says, as long as I keep moving, I can outrun depression. And he eventually recovers. He loves conservation from then on and marries this young woman that had been his best friend when he was a little girl and has a joyous marriage the rest of his life.
Yeah.
We're talking to Doris Kearns Goodwin. You know, Doris, I asked you this question a year or so ago when we were talking about Abraham Lincoln. But when I hear you talk about the Roosevelts, it's like you know them. And it really I don't mean that you've learned about them and you've written about them, but that you know, do you not feel that sometimes when you're talking about them with friends or family or on television? Do you not feel like you have a relationship with them?
No, weirdly you do. I mean, for example, the Franklin and Eleanor book about the home front during World War II took me longer to write than it took the war to be fought. So every morning I'm waking up with them. Every night I'm going to bed thinking about them at night. My kids remember when I was writing Franklin and Eleanor that I'd be in my study and they'd hear me saying, Franklin, just be nicer to her. I know that you love her. Or Eleanor, forget that affair.
Is this true? Is this
yes,
really
I
so?
Swear to God. I forget the affair. I mean, you know, it's over. You got to get over it. And they would wonder, what in the world is going on with my mother?
So do you have remorse? Do you say to yourself, are there moments where you say, I feel a hole that I didn't know the people who I now know so well. I mean, obviously, that's unfixable. But do you feel that?
Yeah. And you know what happens is when I finish each book, I feel a sense of sadness at letting the person go and moving on to the next person. I feel like I'm betraying the one who went before as I move my FDR books out to make room for Lincoln or move Lincoln out to make room for Teddy. It's a crazy relationship you develop with your people.
Well, in Ken Burns' documentary, The Roosevelts, he dramatized a moment which was so upsetting in your book about the FDR and Eleanor marriage when she's opening up his suitcases and she finds something. Tell people about that.
Well, what happened is he had come back from being overseas and she was helping him unpack because he had some flu. And she found a series of love letters from Lucy Mercer to her husband. And she later said the bottom dropped out of her world. She offered him a divorce. But it really was the last thing he wanted. So after much talking, they agreed to stay together in marriage. But it gave her the freedom to go outside that marriage and find herself. She got involved with women who taught her how that she had a voice, that she could articulate a cause, that she could organize. She became Eleanor Roosevelt.
And then you had this map of the household. And again, he talks about this in the documentary too, but because the marriage was somewhat strained, How did they organize the White House household?
Well, in part because Eleanor traveled so much. She was on the road 200 days a year. He needed people around him. So Harry Hopkins, his foreign policy advisor, came for dinner one night early in World War II, never left until the war came to an end, lived on the second floor. Missy LaHand, his secretary, who loved him from the time she was 18, lives with the family in the White House. Lorena Hickok, who has a crush on Eleanor, lives next door to Eleanor. The great Winston Churchill comes and spends weeks at a time in a room diagonally across from Roosevelt's. So when I was writing the book, I became obsessed with the thought of all these people in their bathrobes at night and what incredible conversations they must have had, and wishing when I'd been up there with Lyndon Johnson, I thought of asking, where was Eleanor sleeping? Where was Franklin? Where was... And I mentioned it on a radio program, and Hillary Clinton was listening, so she promptly called me up at the radio station, invited me to sleep overnight in the White House so we could wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept. So 2 weeks later, she followed up with an invitation to a state dinner, after which, between midnight and 2 a.m., the president, Mrs. Clinton, my husband and I, with my map in hand, went through and said, yes, Chelsea is sleeping where Harry Hopkins was, and Bill Clinton is sleeping where FDR was, and we were in Winston Churchill's bedroom, which meant there was no way I could sleep. I was certain he was in the corner drinking his brandy and smoking his ever-present cigar.
Doris, what do you, if, for people who don't know, which is everybody, as much about the Roosevelts as you do, they see the Ken Burns. Was it 14? How many hours? 14? Whatever it is. 14 hours?
I think so.
What would you, and what does he want the takeaway to be?
You know, what I've heard from people is that what they learned the most about, they might have known about Teddy, they might have known about FDR, but they didn't know how central Eleanor was. And I think that's right. And maybe that is because in the old days there were male historians who aren't talking about women in the same way. But without Eleanor, FDR's presidency would never have been as strong as it was. And I think they learned that from that series.
And why do you say that?
Because what it was that she kept an argument going for him. Like, say, even during the war, he's worried about the war. She's worried about the home front. She doesn't want the social revolution from the New Deal to be undone by war, which it often is. So she's worrying about getting women into the factory. She's worrying about civil rights and getting blacks into the job. She's worrying about poverty still. She's worrying about all manner of issues that are social justice issues. And he doesn't sometimes have the time for it, but she goes in there and he told her if she sends him 3 memos a night in a basket, he'll read them. 100, he won't. But he did read the 3.
So in the documentary, you obviously were interviewed and you appeared over and over. Was this like 10 hours of interviews? I mean, you must have been interviewed for a long time.
Well, the weirdest thing is I was interviewed a long time ago, not just for a long time, but you see yourself and you think, oh, my God, I even look worse then than I do now. It's a terrible feeling.
I should say you look fabulous.
And
I'm an objective observer. You know,
late.
You mentioned LBJ a minute ago. I don't think I've seen you since I saw All the Way, which we've been raving about here, and I hope you felt as
Not
great
only
about this.
Did I love
this
it.
Is the Bryan Cranston thing that was at the ART. What did you think about it?
I loved it. And Bryan Cranston actually came to our house to go through all my husband's papers because my husband wrote so many of the great civil rights
speeches.
Oh,
I think I may have read that.
LBJ.
Yeah, I forgot about
and
that.
And we had dinner with him, and then the next night we had dinner with Schenken, the writer. We went to the premiere in New York with them. Bryan's become a friend. I thought it was the LBJ I knew. It was shockingly wonderful.
You know what I did the same day, and I hope you did the same thing? On the same day that I saw All the Way at, was it noon or 1 or 2 o'clock, I went to a GBH party and watched the finale of Breaking Bad with Brian. Please tell me you were a Breaking Bad fan, were you?
I only saw the finale because I knew we were having dinner with Bryan Cranston.
That is a horrible admission. You
all
did the exact same thing you did? You're looking at it right over there.
I mean, I only saw the finale because every time I turned on the TV, someone was getting tortured and I couldn't take it. So I just said, forget about this. By the way, when you have all these people over for dinner, do you cook, Doris Kearns Goodwin, too?
No, we have drinks at our house, and then we go out to dinner.
Good. I would be very depressed if you wrote all these great books and were cooking up this unbelievable meal for everybody as well.
Don't worry, Doris, for a moment.
Okay, that's good.
We know your take is that you should wait a little bit and let history percolate a drop before you judge, but I know you know what's coming. Let's talk for a second about the current occupant of the White House. I've read a number of pieces lately that have talked about his attempt to incorporate a team of rivals approach, obviously, from you and Lincoln, to his White House. The Gateses, obviously a Republican. Leon Panetta from, well, not so much a rival, but from the Clinton minister, Hillary Clinton, actually a rival. And the consensus is when you hear the endless stream of interviews that Leon Panetta is doing, and by the way, even if they're totally true, my position is you wait until the president is out of office if you're privy to inside information. Hillary has tried to distance herself, I would argue, from foreign policy decisions that she was part of. If you agree, where did he fail in implementing what Lincoln was able to do so well and why?
You know, I think part of it was that as many of the people who were around Lincoln who disagreed with him and fought with one another, there was a common mission that they all felt passionately about, which was winning the war and eventually ending slavery. And I think that's what brought these people who didn't like each other and could keep arguing together. And somehow there may have been a common mission at the beginning of the recession for getting out of the economy, but then everything's gotten so split apart. It's hard for us in a country to focus on any one issue. I mean, listening to your program earlier, I mean, we go from the Ukraine to ISIS to Ebola. The bully pulpit that Teddy Roosevelt defined as the president's power to mobilize public sentiment itself is no longer as strong as it once was. You know, even in Reagan's time and JFK, three networks, everybody follows the speech the president gives. Now you may only watch it on your cable network. Before it's done, the pundits are over, and you don't have a chance for a common conversation.
But is any of it Barack Obama's failing as opposed to the environment in which he is serving?
You have to try and understand why he wasn't able to communicate better. Here's a man who was so brilliant in the campaign, and I think you got to say to him what Teddy Roosevelt would have said, you got to talk simply. You got to repeat. Teddy would say, I talk in ways that my Harvard buddies might consider too folksy, but I know I'm reaching the people emotionally. And I think you go back to that inability to explain the health care bill in the summer of 2010, losing the midterm elections. Everything flew from that.
You know, and also, I know, obviously, a totally different person. Getting back to All the Way, I mean, you lived it. But when you see what Lyndon Johnson did to get that Civil Rights Act passed, and that he, and for those who didn't see it and don't know the history, the answer is anything is what he would do. Why didn't Barack Obama, on the advice of a Valerie Jarrett, or call in one of the recalcitrant Republicans, for example, on the Affordable Care Act and say, I know you're not crazy about big governments. I'll make a promise to you. Not another nickel, not one nickel will go to your district if I don't have your vote. I'm serious.
That's what LBJ would have done. There's no question. I mean, he used carrots and sticks, but he also...
And Lincoln as well.
And Lincoln did too. And the trouble is it's all transparent today. I mean, remember there was some deal they were trying to make with Max Baucus, and then it becomes out. The things Lincoln did to get the 13th Amendment, if they'd become public, would have been tough. The things LBJ promised Dirksen, every public works project, dams, pardons, whatever you want, Dirksen. But he also understood that Dirksen wanted to be an historic figure, too. Dirksen, you come with me and bring these Republicans on this bill, and I promise you 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. How could Dirksen resist?
Great.
We're talking to Doris Kearns Goodwin, whose latest book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. I want wondered whether you think in the Lincoln case or even in the FDR case, or any of them actually, if there was certainly in the Civil War days a stronger sense of honor that to do what Leon Panetta did and kind of diss your boss while your boss is still there and your dissing could affect the future of the country. And I mean, it almost an unpatriotic way, I would argue, if that was viewed differently then.
Well, I do think when you think about the unspoken code of honor, for example, with the press and FDR, that they weren't going to show him in his wheelchair or on his crutches because there was a dignity to the office of the presidency. Compare that with our having watched George Bush, you know, in embarrassing moments, or President Ford falling down the steps 1,000 times from the plane, or George Bush Sr. throwing up in Japan. I think the dignity of the presidency itself has lost some of its luster, and people feel free, whether they're the people who worked with them or the press, to talk about them in ways that they might not have before.
So is that our fault in the media, or is that sort of a decline of the character kind of thing?
You know, I just think in general, you know, there's a sense of people being able to say what they want to about people and not take the consequences that we must have felt. I'd like to think even when I was young, but maybe that's just nostalgia of an older age looking back.
You know, one more thing about this, that we discussed part of this with John King yesterday on CNN. I said when members of Congress see the latest CNN poll and see it's 85% disapproval, 13% approval, they know because of gerrymandering in the House they're going to keep their seats. No, but, you know, 2% or something are going to lose their seats. Do leaders, do the Pelosis, do the Boehners, do the McConnells, the Reeds, do they say to themselves, I don't want to be remembered this way? As important as it is, do the members of the Supreme Court say, I don't want to be seen as on the wrong side of history of same-sex marriage in 50 years? Does any of that exist anymore? Or is it all just in the moment?
That's a great question, because you would hope that they went into public life for a reason in the first place, and that they want to have something to give to their children and their children's children to be remembered by. I mean, when the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, or the Voting Rights Act in 65, that's how they talked. They spoke about the fact we will be remembered as the 89th Congress that did this. And that's what helped get people to come along and do the things. And I don't think they think of institutional patriotism anymore, of being a member of the House or a member of the Senate. They're just out there as an entrepreneur raising money to keep their seat.
Entrepreneur is a great description.
And, you know, the scary thing is a young person going to wake up today and say, oh, I can't wait to be Mitch McConnell, or I can't wait to be, you know, Harry Reid? I don't think they're waking up thinking that, because nothing's happening down there.
We're talking with Doris Krinsko. Well, you know, earlier today, we had Charlie Baker on the phone, and we debated the whole Globe story today about that he cried a bit, teared up in last night's debate. And we're going to be talking about it a little bit later with listeners again. But I wonder, you've got this wide breadth of knowledge of history from way back when to the public. Were there presidential criers? And if there were presidential criers, were they known to be criers? Or, I mean, you think of Lincoln, you know, riding his horse through these battlefields with thousands and thousands of dead soldiers. I mean, he must have shed some tears then, but maybe we just didn't talk about it.
Well, we certainly saw the emotion on his face. But think about, I was just thinking about this when you were talking about Charlie Baker crying. Remember when Muskie was running for president?
You
must have talked about that. And that was considered a really negative thing that he allowed his emotions to show. I think
because the publisher, the union leader in New Hampshire, had suggested his wife was
right.
a boozer, essentially.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm sorry.
And probably he should have just hit him in the face instead of crying, because that would have been the right reaction. Like when somebody said something mean about Harry Truman's daughter, I think he did punch the guy.
Is that so?
And people loved it, right? Yeah. So I think, I don't know, it's part of our age, too. It's a more emotional age. People give their feelings. I think it's fine for emotions to come out. I think we girdle our leaders too much, that they're afraid of allowing sometimes, and they become too stiff. So I'm all for it.
But when you think of but Lincoln himself, though, was he known to have been shedding a tear in these public moments or not?
I don't think so. I mean, that's a really – I should know the answer to that question after having lived with him for 10 years.
Okay.
What we knew about him was that there was a melancholy and a sadness, and what he was known for was dealing with that by telling a funny story and by being able to whistle off sadness. So his face would change from this incredibly sad expression to something lively, and his eyes would light up because he would tell a story. So that's what I know more than whether he cried in public.
Speaking of crying, before you go, Doris Kearns Goodwin, how many times did you cry during the 162-game season that we just lived through? For those who don't know, Doris is a relatively big fan of the Red Sox. How painful was this for you?
Well, I'll tell you what. I promised myself the year before when they won so magnificently, and they made me happy while I was finishing the bully pulpit. I couldn't even read the news. The only thing I read were the sports pages. Uh-huh. And they won 90-some-odd games. I was happy most of the year. And then they went to the playoffs, and then they went to the World Series, and we won it at home, and I was there.
Won it at home. Go ahead. Yeah.
And I promised myself, that's it. I'm okay if they don't do well next year. It was hard to remember that promise part of this year, but I just didn't get obsessed about it the same way. If they had never...
Did or did not,
I did not get
because
as obsessed.
Of that
I just stopped reading the newspaper completely. So I was terrible about the news either, because I couldn't even pick up the Globe because I knew that the sports section would be in there. But there's, wait till next year, there's still hope.
You know, Ken Burt's done a phenomenal job on baseball as well. I mean, it is amazing that he's been able to do it, from the Civil War to baseball to jazz to, what am I missing that he's done? The Roosevelt, obviously, but there's other things he's done in between. And that technique of having the voices and the still photographs.
Oh, there's no question that my relationship with Ken began with baseball, because I didn't realize when he came to interview me he was going to be focusing a lot on the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Red Sox, these two lovable loser teams. So I was in it a lot more than I would normally have been. But that made all the difference to my life in a bizarre way, because I was in it so much, publishers came to me and said, why don't you write a memoir about growing up in love with baseball and the Brooklyn Dodgers? And that meant that I brought my parents, who died when I was young, back to life. Instead of just bringing these presidents back to life, it meant more to me than I could possibly have imagined. So I've told Ken I will forever be grateful for him.
Now, Doris Kearns Goodwin, just one quick thing, yeah. Jim. Doris Kearns, we talked about a week or so ago about the ratings for the World Series being down this year, and the theory that baseball is losing its luster as America's pastime because the games are too long or the action is too slow. What do you think about that?
Well, I'll never feel that it's losing the luster for me. But I understand that in a fast-paced culture like we have now, and sadly a culture that likes violence so that football fits that more, that maybe there are things they can do to speed up the game, and I think they should. Because it still seems to me it's the sport that lasts so much of the year. If you care about it, you're going to wonder about it in February and March. You're caring about it in October. I think what's hurt baseball is not so much whether it's a national sport or not, but if you loved players in the old days when I was growing up, they were on that team forever.
Yeah.
And now, at the clink of the highest coin, they go somewhere else. So loyalty is not a two-way street anymore the way it used to be.
So in addition to helping to promote this wonderful Roosevelt series, Ken Burns, what's your next 10-year project you're in the middle well, of? What is it?
What I decided, I'm not going back to Millard Fillmore or Frank Pierce, right?
Oh, so, why not?
What are you doing?
I'm going to bring all my guys together in the room at the same time and write about leadership. Underneath, that's really what I've been writing about. What are the traits that the successful leaders shared? How did they acknowledge errors? How did they build a team around them? How did they stay close to their constituents? How did they communicate in different times? So I'll have Franklin and Lincoln and Eleanor will plop in there too as well.
So we should expect LBJ. This, what, 2024?
No, I promised them 2 years.
Really?
And it's not going to be so fat. I mean, the embarrassing thing is somebody wrote me a letter after reading The Bully Pulpit. She said she loved it. However, she was reading it when she was going to sleep at night and it fell on her nose and broke her nose. So the next book will be 2 years and thinner, I promise.
Okay, may I make a suggestion?
Yes.
This is what I would love to know. And in fairness, you have done this in your books explaining, but I would like to know when you read about someone like Eleanor or any of them, how did they know? How did they know this? Did they know it from their reading as children? Did they have some great teacher in grammar school? Was it their parents? Was it their religion? You know
what do you mean? How did they know to be leaders?
How did they get these qualities, which are so elusive for most of us? You know, where it came from?
It's one of the most important questions I got to think about. I mean, some of the qualities are inborn, you know, perhaps empathy, perhaps intelligence, vitality, but some develop over time. But the really interesting question is, where does ambition come from? Where does the identity of yourself as a leader when you're young come from? And I don't know the answers yet, and that's what's going to be really fun. I had never thought about these questions before, even when I was writing about these guys.
Yeah.
And now I'm trying to think, well, why did they suddenly decide I can be a leader? And then it develops. You take one job, you do well, it goes to the next. But somewhere early on, they have that ambition, and that's what I'm trying to figure out.
We can't wait. Doris, it's great to see you.
Thank you.
So
it's
much
always
for your time.
Good to be with you
guys.
Yeah,
thank you so much for coming in. Doris Krinsker, with her latest book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. She'll also be on PBS next Sunday when WGBH rebroadcasts The Roosevelts. It's part of a day of history on GBH. You can go to WGBH.org for showtimes Sunday, November 9th. Thank you so much for being here. Up next, childhood obesity. We got rates at 18%. Is it ethical to give out the yummy, fatty, sugary candies this Halloween? And is the Ebola quarantine getting more play with politicians than physicians? Our medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In the spirit of Halloween, a health insurance website designed for people to do comparison shopping is dressing up as healthcare.gov. So will the uninsured in search of subsidies get tricked? And ALS has an ice bucket challenge, as you know. Hunger got the Bob Geldof and Bono treatment. So is it time for Ebola to get its celebrity-studded fundraiser? Joining us online for his take on these and other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. And he also co-hosts the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello, Art.
How are you?
Excellent.
And boo.
And to you as well.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the boo and the star-studded Ebola concert, et cetera, we know from your terrific columns here, Art, that you think Ebola quarantines are a bad, bad, bad idea. There's been a big brouhaha this week over this nurse that was kept in an unheated tent after she came back from treating Ebola patients in Africa. I'm going to play a clip for you of her. She's on Good Morning America, Casey Hickox, saying she's going to take legal action to avoid a home quarantine in Maine. Here she is.
I remain really concerned by these mandatory quarantine policies from aid workers. I think we're just only adding to stigmatization that, again, is not based on science or evidence. And if these restrictions are not removed from the state of Maine by tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, I will go to court to attain my freedom.
So what do you think, Art? Is she right?
She's absolutely right. Quarantine is not necessary in the war against Ebola. It is very, very intrusive and probably unenforceable. If Casey Hickox decides to wander out of her house tomorrow, it's not clear what Governor Page and various Maine authorities will do. Are they going to shoot her, taser her, have a cop in a moon suit tackle her? What's going to happen to her if she says, I'm not staying here? They haven't even thought through. I'm looking forward to the court case where she has a right to be there, so I assume everybody there will be in a moon suit as they have the proceedings.
That's a great point.
I suspect what people aren't understanding is this. How many people, I'll give a quiz to you two. How many people right now in the U.S. have Ebola?
Well, there's Dr. Spencer.
There's one that I'm aware of. How many?
And he's it.
Oh, he is it. Okay. I got it right.
So there's one.
Thank you.
Despite people meandering around, wandering around, even Dr. Spencer with his, you know, I went bowling and I rode the subway and ate in restaurants and stuff, the exact number of people with Ebola is one, which tells you you can control this disease with self-reporting. When you get symptoms, you got to call the health department. You probably don't have to restrict liberty of anybody who's not showing symptoms because they're not infectious. People keep saying to me, how do you know? Maybe they are. We know because we've had 40 years of Ebola in Africa. Don't know how to treat it in terms of a cure. Don't know how to prevent it in terms of a vaccine. But we know how to get it. And you really need to have close contact with bodily fluids to get it. It's tough to catch. And that's why there's one person in the U.S. with Ebola and no people out in the streets who have Ebola.
And Art Kaplan, from everything I've read, even if Jim had Ebola right across from me here in the studio, he'd have to be...
That would be the least of your worries.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Okay. But he'd have to be actively sick. He'd have to be, I don't want to get into all the bodily fluids, but you get my drift. And that it seems as though the people who are most likely to catch it are the people that have been dealing with the dead bodies and with the actively sick patients who have been exhibiting all these symptoms really sick.
Yeah, but before you answer that, in defense of the Chris Christies of the world, the Andrew Cuomos, now Daniel Malloy from Connecticut, those are the people they want to quarantine, the people you just described, the people who've come in contact with Ebola patients in West
Africa.
But I'm saying
it's ridiculous because those people that have come in contact are not actively sick at that moment, right? I mean, that's when you catch the disease.
Some have been actively sick. Let me give you a little scenario about why quarantine really gets completely stupid. So we have Craig Spencer, and he's actually in the hospital that we run, Bellevue, NYU's hospital here. So he does have symptoms, and people are dealing with him. They're in suits. He's in isolation. Everybody's very careful. They're well-trained. However, according to Governor Cuomo, I guess all of them should be in 21-day quarantine pretty soon because they're dealing with an active Ebola patient, right? Yesterday, Amber Vincent got released at Emory University. She was cared for, looking at the press conference, by about 30 doctors and nurses. She did have active Ebola. Are we quarantining the people who are taking care of Ebola patients? Well, clearly we're not, because we need all those people. They're the best trained people we've got. So the quarantine idea, not only is it a bad one, it's dangerous, because if you really literally applied it to people who care for the few people who've had Ebola, you'd have to quarantine them all.
You know, it seems I read a lot of your postings, but it seems your basic theme is the only thing we have to fear is fear of Ebola, not Ebola. I don't know if you read Andy Borowitz, one of the great satirists of all time.
Yes, they do, yes.
2 days ago, his headline was, poll, majority of Americans favor quarantining Wolf Blitzer. and the notion being that CNN is helping to spread the fear deal. But you have exactly, you do a 180. You say, rather than quarantining, what we should be doing is sort of celebrating these heroes, give them hotels, raise money, do concerts, do whatever. Make the case for both those things, Art Kaplan.
So if you want to really, because of panic or fear or just a failure to believe scientific evidence that people aren't going to get you sick. Why don't we make it attractive to people to stay in their home or to stay in a particular location? I think these people are heroes who go to West Africa, Spencer and Hickox and these people. They face hellish circumstances when they're there, not just Ebola, but dire poverty and all kinds of other illnesses and sicknesses around. The governments in those places are falling apart. So when they come back, why don't we give them some R&R? Why don't we treat them like heroes and say, hey, you know, we're going to pay your wages when you come back, 3-week vacation, stay in a nice place, order what you want from any food place that you want, and we'll get it to you, and you can have all the videos and CDs and music or podcasts of this show to listen to. And, you know, let's treat them like heroes. Say everybody gets a free R&R vacation. And by the way, let's put on a big rock concert fundraiser to help both pay for these folks and get them wonderful benefits and honor them. Where is that big rock concert?
You know, that
concert
is a great question.
But you posed it, but you don't answer it. You raise it in one of your blogs. What is the answer to the question, do you think, Art Kaplan?
I think people are still creeped out by the disease, the Hollywood folks, people who might put this kind of an event together. Ebola is a frightening thing. It's not necessarily good to it may be okay to nuzzle up to it when somebody is not infectious and just wandering around, but it's not, I think, such great PR to nuzzle up to it right now because of the fear of it. So maybe that's what's inhibiting them. But in all honesty, I don't know. I mean, it is time to kind of celebrate the heroes. And, you know, where's Bruce and Mick and everybody to go up there and inspire us and raise some money and then maybe you could even create a special hotel for heroes. You know, last time I looked, there was plenty of empty space in Atlantic City where Chris Christie is. If he wants to quarantine people, quarantine them in the old Borgata Hotel or whatever. I forget. There was some luxury hotel.
Say one of your favorite people, Trump. You know, you use the word fear, but there's also lack of knowledge. We had Jonathan Gruber in here last week. Well, actually, he was here yesterday for another reason. Jonathan Gruber, the MIT guy who was a key advisor to both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama on their health care plans. And we were talking about this Kaiser Foundation survey, I'm sure you've seen it, that says that virtually nobody, 11% of the uninsured who have to be signing up come November 15th for round two, for the three-month window, only 11% even know that the sign-up period is about to begin. He's much more optimistic, I have to say, than I am, having read this stuff. Where are you on the spectrum of whether or not everybody's going to get their act together in the next 3 months and 2 weeks?
I'm with you. There's going to be a 2-week push with hordes of people coming forward to sign up. I don't see it. I think that's not what's in the news. We get a lot of election news, Ebola news. A young woman, Brittany Maynard, has announced that she's going to take her own life. I think soon, probably November 1st or 2nd or something, is part of assisted suicide, which will set up a whole debate. I can't see the message getting out to people to sign up, which does raise the question, why don't we just automatically enroll them?
Well, in a default plan?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, basically opt out of it if you don't want it. But everybody's in until you get out.
Wow.
And if you said to me, how do you do that? I don't know, but that's why you have that other guest come. I mean,
speaking, Art, of the other guests, one of the things that Jonathan Gruber did say, which I found kind of discouraging, is that you really have to set aside like 3 or 4 hours to sit down in front of your computer and go through Obamacare and go through these plans and figure out which one works for you. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's a huge mountain to climb.
Yeah, it reminds me of the same problem comes up a little bit for Medicare, right? Everybody's got to look at their different plans and you're sort of overwhelmed with information you don't really understand. But I'll say it again. We could automatically default people into one simple, cheapest plan and say, if you don't want that, you got to opt out, take something else. The point was to get people coverage. So why are we, if it looks like 11% are going to get it and we're ready to bring in a lot more folks, then what's the problem with saying, you know, good news, here's a letter in the mail, you're enrolled in cheapo plan A, you have 30 days to get out of that and pick something else or pay a little more or whatever. It seems to me the default is wrong, as the social scientists like to say. Put them in and then let them move out if they don't. And there may be people, for whatever reasons, who don't want to be in it at all. But put the burden on the opt-out crowd.
Well, the only argument against it is they will obviously impeach the president immediately
yeah,
if they do that.
The politics of that.
I have to say, whether that idea has as much merit as you think or not, I haven't even heard it. And it seems to me to be such an obvious, at least, topic of conversation.
I think the politics of that big brother is.
You don't think the president could do it by as if he's not in enough trouble already for executive action?
Maybe he'd have to do it in your second term. But I mean, can you imagine this is like they're forcing you? They're coming into your home.
No, that's a fine point.
But you know, there is a little bit of encouraging news. This New York Times thing was looking at the percentage of uninsured people reduced by 25%. You know, that's something, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something. It's good. I just say, why don't we do better? If you think, as I do, that healthcare is important, particularly for families with kids in them and so on, then let's try to make sure everybody's in, whatever way works, rather than relying on individual behavior and choice to kind of guide you through the maze. I think, let's put it this way. You're more likely to read the stuff if somebody calls you and says,
We're
from the government. We signed you up for this.
That's true. Well, maybe it's an executive action, Jim. I don't know. They might have to ride him out of town on a rail. I don't know if he could get away with this, even in the couple of last years of his last term.
You know, Art, I don't know if you've – every time I feel like this great sense of civic responsibility that you got to write the White House, no matter who's – you go to whitehouse.something and you write a letter. And occasionally, if you – instead of going to the right one – I think it's whitehouse.gov, I'm sure.
By the way, did they fix that? It used to be a porn site.
That's what I'm about to say. If you go to the – it's either whitehouse.com or .org is a porn site. Well, a variation on that theme, healthcare.gov, as we know, is the
Obamacare.
Affordable Care Act thing. I didn't know till last night. Healthcare.com is a – which I would assume is where most people or at least a ton of people would go, is this profit-making sort of consumer reports gives you options. But not only is a lot wrong, they don't tell you about the subsidies. How do they deal with this nightmare?
I don't know. You know, it's similar to if you want to get your driver's license renewed or stuff, there's commercial companies out there.
Yes.
But they don't clearly identify themselves, and they kind of charge you for what's supposed to be free because you can do it on the right site. So there's clearly some need here for the Federal Trade Commission or state consumer authorities to kind of get on board here and sort this thing out. It's basically kind of a bait and switch where you're hitting the what you think is the government site, and then there's a company cloaked behind it. It's wrong. It's just bad. But it's around, as I said, as you guys apparently know too, for the driver's license, social security documents. There's all kinds of other trolls out there who are kind of ripping people off for things that they should be getting for free because their taxes paying for it.
And by the way, if you haven't ever experienced what Art's talking about, if you go to the if you don't go in Massachusetts to the Registry of Motor Vehicles, but go to a close site, if you type something into Google, the graphics on it look almost exactly like the graphics on the official site. I mean, they are clearly consciously trying to confuse you. In that case, though, the worst that happens is you pay a few extra bucks for something that is either free or at least affordable. The problem with this healthcare.com site is you could leave with the impression that you've signed up for the best plan or any plan at all, or didn't even know you're entitled. What is it, 85% or 90% got subsidies in year one?
Yes.
You may not even get the subsidy, which is one of the only things that allows low and moderate income people to afford this thing.
You got to love the free market.
Okay. We're talking Art Kaplan from NYU, medical ethicist extraordinaire.
So Art Kaplan, Halloween, of course, is this Friday. We all know at the same time that our little children have big time problems with obesity in the United States. This time, New York Times piece the other day about little kids showing early signs of heart disease, which is really depressing.
Don't go here with me. Don't go down this road.
Why is that?
I got to go.
Why?
I got to go. I got to go. We want to know about getting a Halloween candy, Art.
I know you do.
Are we unethical?
I know where you're going.
Are we unethical to give out Snickers and Reese's or Reese's, whatever you call them? What do you call them?
Anybody who hands out a toothbrush on Halloween should be put in an Ebola unit.
Okay. I knew you wouldn't disappoint me, Art, on that one. So no sliced apples, no toothbrushes, no dental floss.
When I wander the streets of Framingham with my tattered pillowcase and somebody gave me an apple, I did my best to try and throw it through the window of the house. See, one day a year, you can go bonkers. That's the point of Halloween. You should get enough sugar into you that you need some resuscitation from a diabetic coma. You should fight with your siblings about who's got the best candy. You should wallow in it. I don't care if your mother or father comes the next day and says, okay, that's it. You can't keep this stash around for 3 months because it's not good for you. But that one day, I think, should be bacchanalian. I think it's a good day for kids, although adults keep trying to nuzzle their way into this holiday by turning it into a dating event or some kind of sketchy romance holiday. But it should be a great day for kids. I don't think we should worry about health. I think helicopter parents should land. I think that candy for all.
Well, what about this as a compromise? Because I had no idea that was going to be your position, even though I'm proud of you, Art Kaplan. How about this? Is that prior to you getting, or let's say as a condition of you getting a stash of candy from your neighbor, they have something like a treadmill set up outside their house, and you got to do 2 minutes before you get the Snickers. What, is that a good compromise?
I'm going to tell you something. I had a guy when I was trick-or-treating in Framingham many, many years ago. He used to give out packs of cigarettes.
No!
Oh, I'm not kidding.
My God!
Now, I'm not advocating that. I'm not advocating that. Even, I would say, you know, candy cigarettes. No.
Oh, I remember the candies.
They're still making those, but... You know, we could cut people slack. There is such a thing as enjoyment. We don't have to tell them about obesity every day. And if you want to get the obesity message across, which I'm all for, then, as I said, give it the next day when you say, you know, we got to round up the candy now, and now we're going to take it down and trade it in for the toothbrush, and holiday's over, and that was a lot of fun, but we're through here. So I think you can give them their day and let them have a lot of fun and not have any hectoring from ethicists or doctors.
Okay.
Do-gooders
or whatever.
I knew you'd be with me. Jim wants to give out the slices of apples. I'm glad you were on my side on this one.
Or a little tofu or something.
A little tofu. Yeah,
exactly.
That's good.
Somebody was giving out brownies with kale.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, what's going on today on the Everyday Ethics Podcast?
I think we're going to take a look at this Brittany Maynard situation, physician-assisted suicide, back in the news because this young girl basically has shifted the focus of the debate. I don't think she's added any new issues to, say, what was debated in Massachusetts, pro and con, when it got defeated there narrowly. But she's bringing in a new audience because she's only 29 and newlywed, has a terrible brain tumor. But younger people are paying attention to this, so the optics of the debate are shifting.
Okay, Art Kaplan, thank you as always.
Happy
for calling
Halloween,
in.
Art.
Happy Halloween.
Enjoy your
candy. See you guys at the candy bag. We can swap.
Okay. Yes, you will. We'll be sorting.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, and he co-hosts the Everyday Ethics Podcast.
Thanks, Art.
Up next, gentrification and how it affects the gay bar scene, and evangelicals, are they taking a second look at homosexual or, as they call it, or most of the rest of us call it, gay marriage? We're going to talk about that with Sue O'Connell up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brother. She's Marjorie. And joining us, as she does every Wednesday, is Sue O'Connell. Sue is co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Hey there, Sue.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm dandy.
Good to see
you. Just dandy.
So let's start with this whole evangelical thing. As lots of people know, the evangelical church makes up those huge numbers of Protestant denominations all around the country, have not been particularly welcoming to gays and lesbians. But now there's this group called Evangelicals for Marriage Equality. And in Nashville, the Southern Baptist Convention has held a conference on the gospel, homosexuality, and the future of marriage. So,
yeah.
What's going on?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is they're not having this meeting and this conference in ways to integrate gays into the Baptist. They're looking at it as a problem, you know. And how do we deal with this problem when pastors have transgender parishioners or parishioners who have married and legally in their state and then come to, do we still accept them? How do we integrate them in? And that's the challenge. I mean, this is like the Republican group Go Proud, you know, that is trying to infiltrate from the inside. And more power to them trying to do this, but it's a big battle.
But don't all these surveys show that young evangelicals are enough already with the gay bashing to their parents and grandparents and stuff that they are like most of young Americans saying, what is the big deal? Get over it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the same with climate issues. You know, evangelicals who are of a certain age group and a generation understand the broader and the more important implications, you know, that we can battle over same-sex marriage all we want, but we're also supposed to be taking care of the planet, you know. And there's a lot of very thoughtful things happening within especially the Southern Baptist Convention folks, but it's just not the majority of them. So it's a long way to go. I mean, these are folks that interpret the Bible in a very parts of the Bible in a very strict way, and it's going to take, I think, a few generations before that changes.
But that is what it is. I mean, we've had this discussion with you in about 18 different incarnations.
Boy
the
Scouts.
Bottom line is 18 to 29-year-olds are very different from people who are 30 to the end of their lives.
And you have people now
on this issue and virtually everything else.
And this younger generation of adults want to stay with their faith. You know, in my generation, you had to leave your faith.
Right.
You know, it was
the thing
very,
to do.
Well, it was very rare to be able to be yourself and be with your faith. And these people want to stay with their faith, and they're going to try and expand it. And I'm all for that. I don't think I'd ever have the stomach to do that, but I'm all for it. I've been wrong about the Pope. So there you go.
The Pope?
The Pope. That's what we call him around our house, the Pope.
Now, speaking of not speaking of the Pope, how many states are we up to now on the gay marriage front?
It's like 35, I think, because there's Eric Holder just the Attorney General just talked about allowing DOMA to spread. So it's kind of this volatile number that's going up based on recognition.
And this is all because since the DOMA decision, every single federal court has ruled that you can't.
There's no dog. Dog
do
won't
this.
Hunt.
So why isn't it 50?
Well, because you still have states that haven't pushed it forward and made an issue of it. I mean, you have states that have a Defense of Marriage Act on the books.
But that's a state law challenging it. No, but I understand that. But if it turns out that they rely upon, if they go to federal court and they're relying upon federal decisions, Supreme Court decisions, then in theory, there's going to come a point when 34 or 35 become 50 in the District of Columbia.
Yep. And Puerto Rico is also in play at the moment.
Do you ever stop for a second? And I mean, beyond the wonder of how fast this has come, we've had that discussion 1,000 times. It's sort of like every time you pick up a paper, there's another two states.
I honestly can't keep up. I mean, I was at this City Hall a couple of weeks ago and just having an informal chat with Mayor Marty Walsh. And he said, what number are we at? And I said, well, I was in the car and I heard, you know, I mean, it's amazing not to know. And when we go to press with Bay Windows every week on Wednesday, it seems like just as we ship the paper, another three states, you know, have defined it better.
And it's not just the volume. When you see pieces like a piece written by Matthew Shepard's parents,
knows it,
Matthew and they talk about same-sex marriage coming to Wyoming, and that Wyoming and the state in which this kid was murdered, it is surreal.
I still wonder, though, in those very conservative, very evangelical southern states, you're going to have a judge that is going to be on the gay marriage side. And I think in that culture and climate,
but it's also
harder.
It's not just their point of view, but it's their appetite to have a losing battle. You know, I mean, Jim talks about this all the time. Like, how are they going to be perceived? You know, you can either spend your energy and your political capital fighting a losing battle for a generation of folks who are no longer going to be around, or you can just let it go and just say it's settled law, if you will.
We're talking with Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows. So I picked up this piece about the closing of the last lesbian bar in San Francisco, and there were a bunch of things that really surprised me. First of all, I was stunned to learn there was only one lesbian bar.
So was I, by the way.
For lesbians in San Francisco and a lot of other cities, apparently.
Boston.
But I thought, what is the gay bar in Boston?
Well, it's not a full-time bar. It's a night. You know, when I first came out back in, you know, the mid 80s, there was Somewhere Else, Indigo, Gertrude's,
I love it.
Campus Man Ray, the 1270, and these were bars that were both all-girl or, you know, a mixed bar. Plus, there were, for boys, there was Buddies and there was The Law. I mean, there were tons of nightclubs. And this is true in the straight community, too. The difference in online, you know, why are you going to go pay a cover and buy drinks to get lucky when you can just stay home and, you know, click on the computer?
Online.
But the idea of a five-day-a-week or a four-day-a-week nightclub that caters simply to women and lesbians, just it doesn't have the mass to keep it going. So we have some nights at the bar over in I don't go out anymore, so I can't remember all the names, but over in JP there's one, and there's a floating nightclub that you go with different places, and down in Provincetown. But there's no 5 or 4 night a week nightclub that just caters to women, nor is there one that does dance music all the time just for men. So the environment has changed. And in San Francisco, you've got all these amazing changes happen. You know, this is really the kind of epicenter for open gay life that
right.
really affects the mainstream culture because they've been out for so long
yeah.
and the whole, you know, hippies and openness from the 60s. And you've got the gentrification issue where you've got old dumpy areas where, you know, every up and coming community goes to first that are now worth so much that they're taking the property and making it into
because of the Silicon Valley people.
Absolutely, you know. So it's an amazing
so
thing.
So does this have to do, though, and this is what I thought it was going to say in this piece, and it didn't. It talked more
mm-hmm.
about what you're talking about,
yeah.
gentrification and not being able to afford the rents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you bring up the point of online dating so you can stay at home in the comfort of your living room.
And get lucky, as she said, yes.
Right. But what I thought it was going to say, and maybe it should have said, or I'd like your take on this, is that one of the reasons these lesbian bars are in decline as well is that because being gay is not such a
oh,
big
absolutely.
Deal anymore.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
another
I didn't
reason.
Say that.
No, I remember on the night before Thanksgiving, Wednesday night, going to the very world famous 1270 in Boston. And it was both the night before Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving night where you had come home from the holidays and you went out. Right. And then
right.
Thursday, Thanksgiving, after spending time with your oppressive family, it was the best night of the year to be out in a gay club because everyone's like, oh, my God, I've left them. And now you're sitting there with grandpa watching the game. So there's no real need to get out. At the same time, you've got the issue with women's bars where women are pairing up more and marrying more than they did when before marriage, coupling
yeah.
up. Plus, we don't spend as much, and we don't buy the high-end liquors because we make still less money than men do on the dollar.
Speaking of grandpa, where does grandpa go to get lucky? I mean, what happens? Okay.
You know, I was thinking of the name of the woman that sued because when her partner died, she didn't get the huge taxes.
Windsor.
Oh, Windsor.
Yes.
Edie Windsor.
I remember the pictures of
Edie. In her 80s, right?
Yeah.
yeah.
One
well,
of the
pictures
greats.
I remember is one that they were young
oh, God,
and they first
great.
Met. And they were, not that I should be so superficial, but let me be
oh,
superficial.
Oh, they're good looking people.
They were great.
Gorgeous.
Listen, as soon
gorgeous.
As she got that settlement, I called her.
But the point is, it was such a funny thing to see because
yeah.
it wasn't at all like today. These were women in their little Talbots outfits,
yep.
you know, very preppy with the little white collars at these lesbian underground bars where they were sneaking into and sneaking out
right.
of and hoping nobody saw them.
Yeah, that's all gone now.
Yeah, it is all gone now.
And it's a good thing it's gone, but it really does take away from the sort of the excitement of it, of going, you know, going to a lesbian bar or a men's bar. And, you know, in Provincetown, they still work. But I got to tell you, I have this friend who every time we go out, like once a year in Provincetown to the women's night or the women's bar, she'll go, wouldn't you love to own a women's bar? Wouldn't it be great? And I'd say, look down the bar and there's two gallons of water and nobody ordering drinks on a Saturday night in July. And I'm like, think of the money coming in here. I mean, women don't make as much as men.
That's right.
We don't drink the same high, you know, as a generalization,
yep.
we don't drink the same amount of alcohol, nor do we drink the same high level. I mean, there's only so much rent you can pay with light beer.
And I could be wrong about this.
I'm telling you.
But are not lesbians more monogamous than gay men?
They apparently are, yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, so there's
don't
less
you own
going out.
Bay win- or co-own bay windows?
I do.
What do you mean they apparently are? You know, one of the things, while Marjorie's being superficial about the looks of Windsor.
Well, I was just startled.
They're good looking.
No, but speaking of superficiality, remember all the discussion, and I'm sure you were in the middle of this, when the plaintiffs were being picked
yeah.
in the case in Massachusetts.
Oh, good plaintiffs
yes.
make good law.
What are the names of the two women who since divorced?
Yeah,
the Goodrich,
and
they
picked.
Were both beautiful. But you know what? That was a smart thing to do.
Of course
that
it was.
That was a smart thing to do because we are a very
and they had a kid who was involved.
Society.
She was all for it,
well,
too.
Well, do you remember that? I have to say, the moment that was one of the most
yeah.
powerful moments is when they went, I can't remember if they just stood outside his office.
Oh,
when they went
Romney's
to Romney
office. Yeah,
and said, what do you want us to tell our child?
And he said, you should have thought of that before you
it
had
was
her.
Just, it was a
brilliant,
shocking and incredible
At least he
moment.
Didn't say, put her on the roof of the car when you go on vacation.
No, that's for Seamus. That's all. That's really not nice. That's totally inappropriate.
Let's move on to this whole Michael Sam case. He was a guy that was supposed to be the first gay guy to play in the NFL. He's not quite playing in the NFL.
Well, he did.
Yeah.
Officially.
Well,
he's officially an
NFL
player.
He is.
Yeah.
He was drafted,
but he hasn't like started or played a game.
Now, this I learned. I sound like I've known this my whole life. I've learned that when you are on the practice team, you are a member of the team. So therefore, he is officially the first NFL player.
He just hasn't
played
in an NFL
game.
Right.
He was cut by the Rams. He signed by the Dallas Cowboys to their practice squad, and then he was cut from the practice squad. So here's what I want to know. Do you think he was cut, the game has anything to do with this, or he's just not, you know, Dallas Cowboys material?
I'll tell you, the first time that he was cut from the Rams, my friends who know these things were like, well, he was on the bubble. You know, he could have gone either way. If I were the Rams, I would have kept him because of the revenue that you're going to get from the shirts. At one point, he had the number two selling jersey in the NFL. So they viewed Dallas, the Cowboys, as being brilliant for picking it up. But, you know, his talent wasn't... You know, we definitely wouldn't even have known his name if he weren't openly gay. So it's a historic thing and it's great, but I think it just is what it is.
Well, that's what I was wondering. It clearly is great for the lesbian gay community. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it was great for him, though. I wonder if he...
Oh, are you kidding? He's going to write a book. He's going to go he's going to be at every human rights campaign dinner from here till the end of time. He's got a huge revenue stream.
He's an historic figure.
Yeah. He's a historic figure.
I mean, look at Jason Collins. Jason Collins is not exactly a great basketball player.
But if you really want to play football, and I assume this guy really does want to play football, I think that the whole idea of this being a distraction.
Well,
you know, the idea that the media was going to be there, and every first movie made, oh, Michael Sam did this, Michael Sam did that, and a lot of football players are like, enough already.
Oh, you mean
Michael
he might have made a team and stuck with the team if he stayed in the closet?
I think if he had stayed in the closet and waited till he played a few downs and then he announced he was gay.
No, I think we saw the amount. I mean, he's talented, he just wasn't talented enough.
Okay, all right.
So how much you know about football now?
I actually knew a lot about football, but the whole practice team things was all new to me.
Yeah, I didn't know it either. I didn't know that was a whole separate thing.
Why don't you describe the whole practice team thing to us now?
Well, I assume that they're the guys that suit up in practice with the main team.
Well, they're
and that's
teams.
Why they're called the practice
that is
team,
why they're
I think.
The
that's
I do know a lot about football, actually.
I
might just
excuse
don't
me.
Follow it
why don't
anymore,
you tell us your high school
do.
Boyfriend went on to be the captain of the team at the University of Pennsylvania. He was the captain of your high school team.
He was a good football player.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah,
good.
There he was.
Now,
that's
Sue,
why I knew, because I had to watch all these games.
Right.
We're talking to Sue O'Connell, who is the
co-publisher
of Bay Windows in the South End News. Mm-hmm. What's the other guy's name again?
Jeffrey Coakley.
Jeffrey
J.P. Coakley.
Fine. It's very important we say that. So you, the Bay Windows endorsed Martha Coakley.
We did.
And the reason I said that is not only so that people know that was your choice, but obviously so you come to the next question with, I don't mean bias in a pejorative way, mm-hmm. but in an observational way. What'd you think of, we had Charlie Baker on before, what'd you think of the emotional moment last night's debate?
You know, a couple of things. One, I think Charlie Baker personally is a very likable guy. He kissed me in the hallway a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Didn't make any news, but I let it, you know, I let it go. So I don't disbelieve that was just alligator tears, although I am enormously entertained that he was crying, telling the story about someone who did not accept, was it government funds? So as a bean counter, he was very happy that somebody didn't take the money, and that's
football.
Why he was
I
crying.
It was college scholarship.
Yeah, but it's a scholarship, so somebody didn't take the scholarship, and he was crying because they didn't take a handout.
Yeah.
I mean, I just thought
so
that was
so where are you going with this? That you don't question the authenticity of the moment, but
right.
why?
The motivation that made him cry is what I'm questioning.
Okay, so how do you think average, assuming that people judged it on its merits, this moment that I think, and I know we had a caller right before we had a break, and we're going to discuss it with listeners again in a few minutes, who said he was disappointed that we're not spending, not just we, but people are not spending as much time on the issue differential between the two of them. But this is an optic moment that people are going to remember.
Important.
So how do you if people could really shed their partisan skin, mm-hmm. which is almost impossible, how do you think this plays out? We're only 6 days away.
Well, I think that it shows first of all, I think that these type of questions are important. I was saying to the gang in the control room, Linda Ellerbe, in her books And So It Goes, said everyone thinks it's a stupid question until they get a great answer. You know, so asking a question like this really allows us to see the person as they are. I mean, Mitt Romney never cried, and we can see why now.
Well, Martha Coakley, you're in Dorsey, didn't cry either.
Well, Martha saying, you know, at a funeral.
She said she did John Laughlin's
funeral. Yeah, I get that. But it just, you know, again, it doesn't really seem to be connected to what's happening. So I think it's important for folks to see that.
See, I think, again, assuming for the moment that I find it, it's one thing to say that you don't like it in a candidate.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. I have to say, I know him a little bit. When someone called before, we've gotten a lot of Facebook postings saying it wasn't genuine, it was cooked. I have to say that really, to me, takes a level of proof or something that I'm not quite.
Yeah,
I don't think it was cooked because I've seen him do it over and over
in our studio
two weeks ago. In our studio, in our debate, in times when I've been out with him talking about something or interviewing him.
Also,
as a reporter.
Wasn't an affirmative presentation. He didn't know the question was coming. He's responding.
No, he's a weeper. He's a weeper. I mean, a lot of people are weepers.
Listen, I made Doris Kearns Goodwin weep in the hallway when
you
I
did?
Hijacked her to get my my book autographed. I actually lugged my entire Rivals book in, and I just told her about how her arguments in the book or her explanation in the book about the expansion of the slave states really informed how same-sex marriage battles have been fought. I would run into Mary Bonato all the time from the Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, who just got the MacArthur Genius Award.
I got the Macmillan Award.
You got
the Macmillan
Award.
$10.
And we would talk about her book, you know, and how that, and she started to genuinely mist up and feel moved. And I don't think you can script that.
Can I say one thing in defense of Mitt Romney, since you've been critical of him twice?
Just for fun.
I don't know. I mean, I've interviewed Mitt Romney a lot of times when he's governor. I don't know him at all. I thought that was it a Netflix documentary?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it
was
showed
great.
A guy who really loves the people around him, loves his kids, loves his grandkids, loves his wife. And but I'm not saying it's good enough reason to make somebody president or governor or whatever. But the notion, I mean, the guy.
See, Jim, that's not good enough for me. I'm just saying that if you need to love people beyond your family.
Oh, I'm not quarreling with that. I'm not quarreling with that. But when you said you didn't see him cry.
There's too many in his family. He can't possibly love. I mean, you get that Christmas card from Mitt Romney every year. It's like, you know, a small town. And everybody looks unbelievable.
Well, because they dress the same
in the
photograph.
Listen, if I were going to be drowning, I would want him to save me. I think he should be in charge.
Remember
FEMA?
That?
You should
I
did
think
on a jet
be,
ski in Lake
Winnipesaukee.
There's a whole bunch
out.
Of things he should be in charge
remember
of,
when
just
he was
not
wearing,
the country.
He was wearing a bathing suit.
He's
he
hot.
Was about 50 or 55 years old.
He's a lean,
every time
he's
I
a
look
lean
at the
muscle
Romney's,
machine.
He
I
is.
Know,
so
he is.
You know, no liquor, no cigarettes, no coffee. Too late for most of us.
And everyone's
but
getting a planet.
And everybody's getting the planet. That's right. That's what you could have looked like if at 50 in your bathing suit, if only you'd not done all these terrible things. Do they eat, you know, Halloween candy? I'm not sure.
Chocolate has caffeine.
What's that?
Well, we're talking about Mormonism now. That's how we
He has vanilla Coke. So there's a little caffeine in vanilla Coke.
So
remember
that?
John Keller wrote that
Donny
piece.
Osmond, yes. Donny Osmond has Coca-Cola, Diet Coke.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
I don't know why I know these things.
I don't think Mitt Romney goes for the double lattes at Starbucks.
I don't know. But maybe you should ask him next time you see him rather than Sue O'Connell speaking as we have. Sue, it's great to see you. Thank you.
Sue O'Connell is the co-publisher. I never always say the publisher. She's the co-publisher of Gay Windows. Thank you very much for being with us.
She just said of Gay Windows.
Did I say Gay Windows?
Yeah. That's okay, though, right? I mean,
you know, it is. It's Bay Windows,
you know,
Gay Windows.
One of these days, I'm going to make it through 3 hours without 19 mistakes.
There's only one.
But today is not the day. Okay, up next, we're going to talk about what we've been talking about with Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows, not Gay Windows. The whole issue of people crying. Maybe I'm going to take a break and do a little crying myself right now. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you missed last night's gubernatorial debate, the question that will likely make the biggest impression, or at least the longest-lasting impression of the entire campaign, is when Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley were asked when they last cried. Baker responded with an anecdote about a fisherman he had met somewhere on the campaign trail.
And then he said, "See those two kids up there?" And he pointed to these two boys on the boat. And he said, "Those are my sons." And he said, they were both spectacular football players at New Bedford High School who were given college scholarships to go play football. And I told them no. I said, you're going to be fishermen.
When you see candidates tear up, does it humanize them? Does it make them look weak? Or does it betray the huge physical and mental toll that a campaign like this one can have on someone? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Charlie Baker joined us earlier, and he described what the moment was like. And he made a point which I hadn't thought about, is that he did have time to think about what his answer was going to be, because Martha Coakley got the question first. He was deciding whether to talk about this anecdote or another. He talked about this one. And we asked Brian McGorry this question. We both said the same thing Brian did. We have no idea how this is going to play in the campaign. What we do know, at least I believe, is the lasting image. It may have no impact. It may drive people toward him, because the whole, remember the question we asked him in the debate? He just referenced that when he was with us about what's the piece in the whole campaign. What's the mischaracterization about you that drives you most nuts? He says that I'm a numbers cruncher and I don't care about people. And so my sense is that
I wanted to ask him about crying, but you said put the kibosh on that question.
Can I tell you something? I rarely admit, and I know you're going to say, what a shock, that I was, I wouldn't say wrong about something. I would never have asked that
question.
Neither
would I. I never would have either.
You know, we were discussing for our campaign, do we want to lighten it up during the debate? And the way we did for about 30 seconds only at the end was we played that question, which I thought was very cute, from Ty Burr, the movie critic of the Boston Globe, about, you know, who would play you in a movie. I have to say, when I watched it last night, before Charlie Baker's answer, actually before Martha Coakley's answer, I was listening, was that on the radio? Well, I was listening on the radio, and I'm saying to myself, that is pathetic. By the way, all three of the moderators, Bob Oakes, Andy Hiller, and Janet Wu, I'm fans of all three of them, I should say. I forget who asked it. I'm saying, I cannot believe that they asked that question. And Martha's answer, I thought, was solid, not wildly emotional, but solid. And then Charlie had a moment that I think is going to stay with people. We want to know what kind of impact both Charlie's moment had. And stepping back for a second, he's not the only one. There have been plenty, most recently or most notably, many people think, I'm sure she would deny it, that Hillary Clinton came from behind in the New Hampshire primary in 2008 to beat the front runner, Barack Obama, because she welled up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, right before the vote. A lot of people credit that emotional moment for someone who many voters thought didn't have any emotion is what put her over the top.
I also think if you are Martha Coakley, you have to look at her career. She was a prosecutor prosecuting gruesome crimes. Mm-hmm. She was the head of the district attorney's office talking to the media every few days about gruesome crimes.
Yes.
She was the attorney general of the Commonwealth. So, you know, after you do that so many times in your career, you have to sort of steel yourself because you would be a basket case all the time. Her life story is much different from Charlie Baker's, who was a big wig in the Weld administration, went on to run Harvard Pilgrim. He's involved in these venture capital firms and stuff like that. He has not spent a career sitting with people who've just experienced the worst tragedies of their lives. So I think that that is part of the reason for Martha Coakley to not get as emotional.
I think you're right.
You know what I mean?
I do. 877-301-8970. So what do you think about it in Charlie's case? And not so much, what impact do you think it's going to have on the campaign, if any? And how do you feel in general about candidates who show their emotion in a very out front kind of way?
Amina just emailed and said, it's really funny with public figures. When a man cries, we question his authenticity. And when a woman cries, we say she's too sensitive. But in these cases, in the cases we're talking about, people did not say that about Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. She got weepy and she won the primary that was suspected to be won
by
Barack Obama. And I think it's changed a little bit, because I don't think when Barack Obama himself teared up on the eve of the election in 2008 and 2012, mm-hmm. people thought he was wussy. It was kind of like a moment where he's talking about his grandmother and those kinds of things. And I remember seeing, and you were there as well, when down in 2008 when Barack Obama actually was getting the nomination out there in Denver, and you've talked about it on the air with Deval Patrick, and what's his name? Doug Wilder.
Doug Wilder from Virginia,
yeah,
first black governor.
They were pretty emotional.
No, they were crying is what they were.
Barack Obama up on the stage, you saw a lot of people.
And by the
crying.
Way, that's not telling a tale out of school. We've talked about it. And I believe that Deval Patrick wrote about it in his book. So let's take some calls on the issue of at least last night. Pat and Lowell, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Pat.
Hey, I didn't see it on TV. I was listening to it on the radio.
Yep.
So there was no visual cue that the crying was going to start. All of a sudden, he's blubbering away there, unable to finish the sentence. He couldn't even figure out what the story was really about. And it reminded me that he got extra airtime on your program because you guys had asked, I guess Marjorie cut off Coakley before she even got to answer the most important question in the preceding debate.
What was that? Oh,
what was that? What did I cut her off on?
They were both asked about what's the biggest misconception. You gave him something like 2 minutes and she got 7 seconds. Even Brian McGrory, when he was on, said it would have been nice if we could have heard her answer.
Maybe I'm mistaken. I thought she stopped. I thought Pat, she gave the answer and stopped. I could be wrong and you could be right, but I thought she gave a very brief answer.
Well, hey, Pat, can I tell you something? Pat, can I speak for a second, if you don't mind? You've struck a nerve with me because one of the things that Marjorie and I pride ourselves on being is scrupulously fair. And my response to you saying the same thing now 4 times about the extra time is Martha Coakley is running for governor. She doesn't work for us. If Martha Coakley at any time felt she was being treated unfairly in a debate or in the studio, I would hope, and I think she would probably say this, that she would make that point clear and assert herself. But Pat, thank you for your call. There are very few things. If people know me through the radio, there are very few things that put me over the edge. That's one of them. I really, really go out of our way to try to treat everybody, regardless of political stripe, regardless of our own preferences, as fairly as is humanly possible.
Well, I think that they're two very different people. Martha Coakley tends to get to the point a lot quicker. Her answers in general in the studio and in the debate last night are shorter. Baker rambles. I mean, he talks
too.
A lot longer, and it puts you in a difficult position where you have to interrupt people, and sometimes it's harder.
No, but the point that Pat made – no, Pat, the expression she used, which set me off, and my apologies, yeah. Pat, but you did, is she said you cut her off was the expression.
I don't remember doing
expression.
That, but maybe I'm mistaken.
And by the way, we cut them both off plenty because during the debate because our goal was to move it through as many issues as possible. But thanks for the call, Robert. In Burlington, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Robert.
Jim, it drives me crazy how scrupulously fair you are sometimes.
Are you being sarcastic or no?
Yeah, because you're a Democrat and you still, you know, sometimes I think you're cutting too much slack on the other side. But
oh, you think I bend over too far backwards? Is that your point?
Yeah, but that actually, yeah, I'm kind of kidding with you, but
okay, well, then I won't hang up on you. It's okay, Robert. Go ahead, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Great. Anyway, I watched your debate last night. First of all, let's stipulate that both of these individuals must be physically and emotionally exhausted.
Right.
So maybe they are given to, a breakdown of sorts. But I have to say, Charlie, I mean, he was kind of slobbering, but I honestly couldn't. I wish he had explained why that was so emotional to him. I mean, the two young men, I don't know how old they were. They had scholarships to college, and the father wouldn't let them take them. Was he crying because here are two kids that could have gone without needing any public assistance from us? Or why was he crying? I mean, I guess I don't really understand that. Does he cry when, you know, a single mother has to take time off from work and is getting docked for her pay? Is that what? I mean, I didn't know really, and I know I'm tilting more Democratic here. But I didn't understand really over that particular.
Well, Robert, I have a theory. I'm just speculating. But Charlie Baker's got 2 sons and 1 daughter, and I know at least one of the sons is a football player. Maybe the second kid is too. And I suspect he was thinking about the comparison between his own sons, one of whom just got player of the game or something a couple of weeks ago at Union College.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm guessing. I have no idea.
No, but your point, by the way, Robert, your point is a point that that Sue O'Connell was trying to make too. Is the question is what moves you to showings of emotion, and you were obviously referencing the question, which I think is question 4, the whole question about sick leave and who gets paid, who doesn't, and what the mandate is and that sort of thing. And by the way, just Robert, thanks for the call. Charlie's position is that the threshold above which someone should get paid, mandated paid sick leave is a workplace of 50 employees. The ballot question says 11 or more. Let's go to Sandwich, where Sue is on the phone. Sue, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what was the purpose of that question anyway in a debate like that?
Well, I have to say, and again, I don't mean to be critical because I've asked some doozies in my – I am with you. And I guess the end arguably justified the means, but I couldn't have asked the question. Well, I agree.
You know
with
what I thought? And once again, I'm going to speculate wildly here, yeah. Sue, but I thought it was because one of the narratives of this race has been that Martha Coakley doesn't emote. You know, that she's a cool cucumber and she doesn't show a lot of emotion.
What, and she might say, I haven't cried in years? Is that what you...
Well, that's one of the stories. And Charlie, like I said a million times now, is known to be a weepy guy. So I thought maybe it was more directed at Coakley than it was at Baker. You know, Martha, let your hair hang out for a minute. You know what I mean?
But if that's the case, it was not really an objective question. To me, it didn't make any sense in a debate like that to ask a question like that.
Yeah, well, we ask a lot of stupid questions in debates.
We've
done a couple ourselves.
You
know, I mean, what were some of the other things? We ask about who'd play in the movie. That wasn't exactly relevant to politics in Massachusetts. They asked some other ones last night that weren't exactly about the issues in Massachusetts. I think people think it's going to break it up or something like that.
You try to. I mean, the goal is, Sue, in those things. And by the way, we can give you a little bit of an inside story. When we decided to play Ty Burr's question, the movie critic of the Globe, which I assume you wouldn't have liked either, during our debate about who would play you in a movie, we actually had a debate internally about whether we should do it. If we have 58 minutes of one of five debates and only one of a couple that are one-on-one, it was the first one-on-one, do you spend time doing that? And the decision we made was it's a good way to break the tension for 60 seconds before the end of the debate. But last night, obviously, it went on longer. But I don't know what their agenda was. I have no idea. But it obviously produced a pretty memorable moment. You know, thank you for the call, Sue. Somebody called earlier, and he was really smart and good at the end of our first discussion about this, and said something like, I want to hear about their differences on the issues and that sort of stuff.
Right.
The reality is that for the most of that is not penetrating. And I'm not suggesting it's not important. It is hugely important. If you even were to ask people who watch all the debates, what's the difference between the two candidates, I guarantee you what they'd focus on are the attacks that one has directed at the other. Charlie Baker believing that she shouldn't have defended the state on this lawsuit by this children's organization. Martha saying, why did you triple your salary? Do you think the average person, I'm not speaking disparagingly, knows the difference on education?
No.
Which matters to everybody?
Well, because they're not, well, they are dramatic. I guess he's much more in favor of charter schools than she is, and he's much.
He thanked her at the NECN debate the other night for coming around, so he acknowledged that she's essentially where he is.
On charter schools?
Yes.
Well, she's been, I disagree with that. I think he's
no,
much
but
more
I mean,
of a
he's the candidate, not you, is what I'm saying.
But in any case, I think that the sick leave thing is a dramatic difference. It's a ballot question, and she has embraced the is it 11 and under? The people
under 11, you get unpaid sick leave mandated. 11
and
or more,
said
you get paid.
It should be
50
companies with more employees. So I think people are they're resonating on that one. I think absolutely true, and I think people think he's going to. If you are big into social programs, welfare programs, EBT cards, that kind of stuff, I think people think he's going to be much tougher on those kind of programs.
877-301-8970. We have a couple of minutes left. Let's go to Richard in Cambridge. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
Excellent.
I'm a little ticked off at Charlie Baker. In fact, more than ticked off.
Over what?
It's about time he met real people and not wait until he's running for governor to see the effects of the Republican Party and the Tea Party people on the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
So he sheds a tear. Big deal. You know, he should lead in the talent group and drag the rest of them with him to Gloucester and New Bedford so they can meet some of these people who have given up generations because of decisions of economy and government and so forth. I don't want to give him any credit for this. This reminds me of John Silver when he was running for governor, and I could see that he would be out of control if he was governor all the time because the press would be punching his buttons. They're going to do the same thing with Charlie Baker, punch his buttons and get him to cry.
We got it, Richard. Thank you very much for the call. Let's try to squeeze one more really quick one in. You have about 30 seconds. Mary, you're in Framingham. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you doing?
Excellent, thank you.
I can't believe that everybody missed the point of the tears with the fisherman story. The point was the fact that the boys don't have a future.
Right.
Because fishing doesn't have a future. It's a proud father. He wanted to pass on his proud legacy in his family, and he didn't know what was going to happen to the industry. And that was the point, and that made me tear up.
Yeah, you think about these guys losing their opportunity to go
lost,
to college
yeah.
and have exactly, and you're exactly right. That's a great point, Mary.
Mary, thank you very much for the call. Well, obviously, this provoked a decent amount of passion on both sides.
Very passionate. It was a great question, Jim. I wish you'd thought of it.
What was the question? Now, tell me the truth before we go. If we had agreed, would you have been willing to ask that
no.
question? And again, this is not faulting
like
the
question,
three of
Jim,
them.
Jim, you ask it.
No, I could not. I just could not have done it. And again, not only is it not to criticize the three moderators,
yep.
they produced an outcome that
That's
everybody's
right.
going to remember.
You know what, Jim?
What?
We blew it.
Next election, question number one.
Okay. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Alex Beam from the Boston Globe, MIT economist John Gruber, on what breast cancer has to do with the 12 parents he and his wife owns. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer is John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Brody. I'm the guy who wanted to ask the question, but
That's
Marjorie
right.
said I couldn't.
That's right. I said you couldn't.
See
Thank you
tomorrow.
For listening. See you later.